darüber. Also ja, all hier, weißt du was? Is it your apologies for the NCLP members, Honorable Makubela and Honorable Bloom is in the first state with the Select Committee on Corporate Governance and Traditional Affairs and Oversight. And Honorable Chani is in the Northwest Province for the state of the province of West. The chairperson will be anxious. Honorable Chani. Also welcome to the SSC Deputy Chairperson. We are conducting this hearings in terms of the Moneyball Procedures and Related Matters Act, also sticking to the specific time frames. Hearings today and tomorrow, and then Monday, the consideration of this committee's report, jointly with the NCUP Select Committee on Finance, and then the debate in the NA on Tuesday. So that will be the proceedings. Of the members, you've got an agenda in front of you and the relevant documentation. Without further ado, to the FSC, you may do your presentation.
First of all, I apologize for the chairperson of the commission, Dr. Patai, who had to leave suddenly last night at Kobe to deal with the emergencies in Johannesburg. I am accompanied here by Henry Dixon, he's our parliamentary liaison, joined shortly by I will take you through very quickly a short presentation that we presented on the request of the request of the commission. Also, you actually understand that for the commission, basically, this is a defense. Most of our submissions basically tend to be focused on the division of revenue issues rather than on the procurement. But that being said, we basically have to look at all of those things in order to make any recommendations or submissions in terms of the division of revenue. So what I'm going to do is take you through some of the thinking in the commission based on the web. That we do.
Excuse me, the document we are working from, it's the same that we've got in front of us.
I actually have a PowerPoint presentation in
the just for the members to follow.
Okay. I'm not sure whether that's going to take place. Yeah. Okay. So basically, we wait on the letter that was sent to us. I'm going to talk briefly on the fiscal framework, looking at the macroeconomic outlook underlying the 2010 budget, and maybe make a few remarks around what the work of the commission, our modeling exercises that we undertake. Basically tell us about what is happening as we emerge from the economic crisis. We're going to speak a bit about the revenue tax proposals and what we think about them, and then just a few remarks around what we think, because, like I say, this is a learning period for all of us. For the Commission, this is definitely a learning period. So we'll talk a bit about the kind of transparency that one basically would like to see as we move forward, if we have to engage in more detail with these issues. I'm not going to get into any issues to do with the numbers. I think the National Treasury did planning processes, both in government and also in the private sector. That's an important point to note. Now, in terms of the fiscal framework, basically what we say here is that it complements the monetary policy position that the bank takes and tries to consolidate the commitment of government to medium-term macroeconomic objectives. Now, over the past few years, government has adopted an expansionary fiscal policy position, with quite a lot of discretion involved. We saw periods where the budget deficit was maintained at very low levels, and that basically was an indication of a very healthy economy. And then what happened is that we suddenly went into a recession. And the experience from that recession basically points to a need for a commitment to, I'm not going to emphasize the cash surplus, but just to try and contain the growing expenditure. Because at the end of the day, what we saw was a balloon almost in terms of where we were and how we were actually hit. We ended up with a very high budget deficit in comparison to where we started. Now, in terms of the work that we do as the Commission, this is just a little a chart to indicate some modeling exercises that we do at the Commission. What we see here is three types of scenarios. Basically, the blue one, indicates the business as usual kind of scenario. The trend basically is a steady growth in the economy. And then the purple one basically indicates the period when the recession started to set in. And the green, I don't know whether it's green or yellow, but the green one, instead the green one basically indicates those two, the purple and the green, indicate certain assumptions about the impact of the recession on the South African economy. So we have a business as usual, a moderate impact, and a severe impact. Now, the choices that one basically would have had to make would be to assume what the impact of the recession would have been, and if the recession has been severe on the South African economy. What we are saying here is that we will never get back to the past where we were before the recession hit, at least until 2015. So beyond 2015, we will be below the long-term trend. Now, the moderate one, which is the purple one, basically shows a scenario where the economy had some built-in levers that basically to deal and also to cushion itself from recession. So this could be deliberate measures or could be simply underlying factors in the macroeconomic environment. Now, if we look at the budget that was tabled by the Minister of Finance, basically it does indicate a very high degree of optimism for the future, which would basically suggest that the impact of the recession would be more around the moderate than the severe impact. So there's a possibility to basically get back to and back to where we were in terms of the current plan that the U.S. government has adopted as we look at the crisis, basically to try and stabilize and contain expenditures in certain areas, and also to try and reap some savings out of the economy, basically falling out in the form of your corruption and all of those things. and also because you are coming out of the recession, you also have to be very cautious about what you do on the revenue side. And what we've seen here is a little bit of deferment in the implementation of the new revenue proposal. So the implementation or the coming into effect of the new tax proposal basically has been deferred. So that is also one positive way of looking at what with respect to this, we also note the increase in debt service costs, and also at the same time, the public sector wage bill or the public sector personnel spending. Now, what one wants to say here is that we need to be very cautious in terms of how we deal with the spending on personnel in times of rising debt costs, because one would then have to look at what constitutes that debt. Now, if that debt is driven by personnel expenditures, which would classify under current consumption spending, and also obviously we need to cushion the poor, so we have a very big social security transfer system that we can't wish away. And those two areas basically are very rigid in terms of adjusting. They're very rigid areas that you can't actually control just like that. So going forward, we need to be very careful how we actually do that. And I think government has done quite a lot in terms of cleaning up the social security grant system and the inefficiencies that were associated with it. I think in the press, we have seen quite a lot of stories around the cost of administering the grants themselves and administering the social welfare transfer system definitely on the high side. So that might need to be repaired. Okay, so I have actually talked about the rigidity of the types of spending areas that we need to be really careful about. And also in 2007, I'm sorry for that little type of it. It might actually worsen both the service that we have. Ultimately, in the long term, that might have a negative impact on the credit rating of the African economy. What we are really saying is that we need a very prudent approach to balancing public service expansion, which basically has to deal with vacancies, because we're all aware that there's quite a substantial amount of vacancies in the public sector. So it's not only the payment to current employees or incumbent employees, but also payments that are still to come as we close the vacancies that we actually have. And that's my there's also expectations, because every time you must have a budget, you must increase welfare grants, you must so there are expectations around those things that can actually put some risk forward. In terms of the revenue proposal, like I said, I'm not going to talk about numbers. Here, basically, it's issues of principle. And one area where one sees the optimism that government has with respect to the recovery is also the tax relief that was mentioned before, and that has to be supported in terms of the environment in which you are coming from. But looking at the treatment of these taxes, this is an area that is always interesting, because when you're looking at what one would call socially undesirable kind of consumption, these are taxes on your alcohol, cigarettes, and whatever, we see quite differential tax rates being applied on different types of alcohol. Now the point basically is it okay to tax your wine, for example, at a lower rate than you take your hard alcohol, like your whiskey and all of that. There's a little money that you can make there, because alcohol is the switching that people might make as you take the other end. So that creates potential for distortion in the revenue base on we think that it is important that as we move forward, we very much move in the direction of specifying the long run objectives that we want to follow. Are we going to reduce spending, or are we going to increase it? That's a critical choice. That's one we have to make as we move forward. I think what is very clear is that there is a significant need for government to stimulate the economy in order to move out of the recession. Now, with the demand on the spending side and probably very little room on the recession side, we might need to start thinking about what sort of fiscal rules we want to put in place to fix our, for example, debt to GDP ratio, to fix our revenue to GDP ratio, and all of those kinds of things that we can actually work towards and improve. I think this is my last slide. Basically, what I want to talk about here is the transparency that one would probably need as we move forward, in order for all sorts of people to be able to engage with this kind of process. It is important that the fiscal or macroeconomic framework be subjected to independent scrutiny. Here, what I mean is that if you have to engage with some of these issues, there are certain assumptions. Government also has its own models that it takes, and certain assumptions that they make around economic growth, around inflation, around all those kinds of projections that one makes and basing the fiscal framework upon. There will be a need to basically be able to scrutinize those things and be able to say whether or not the assumptions that we base our projections on are actually credible. So you don't want a situation where all the time your projections on revenue tend to be so far away from what you actually end up hearing correctly. Your projections on growth end up being so far away from what you suggested. You want a system that actually allows for scrutiny of those assumptions so that we are all I think there's also a concern that the Commission would like to express around increasing contingent liabilities and guarantees to private sector. That probably needs to be managed properly managed, basically, as in careful management of when and how we basically come in. Because what some of these guarantees tend to do is they turn out to be implicit bailouts. I mean, the system on which most of our financial management of government is based is a system that allows for no bailout. And so when we start guaranteeing some of these areas, implicitly, those can be looked at as bailouts, and in times of extreme failure, you will have to come in and save those institutions, and what that creates is probably some undue burden on future generations. And so that's important. I think the recapitalization of the CBSA, whilst it's actually quite welcome, it's also an issue that needs to be carefully monitored, because the intention is to allow CBSA to leverage funding to be able to lend to poor municipalities. I think in terms of the figures that we have, most of CBSA's lending is actually to credit worthy clients. Vitamin spaghetti, so that is the power in Morocco. So the market basically can get sorted because the CPSA has this power. So what you're really saying is that we need to carefully monitor that so that we actually ensure that the CPSA is on positive to what we're trying to do.
Thank you, Mr. Kumalo, for the presentation. Would you call the people that are traveling with you to come and join you here? Will you please? Yeah. Your presence is requested close to Mr. Kumalo. The Federation of Democratic Unions of South Africa, you are welcome here. Please introduce yourself. You've been to this forum before, last year when we deliberated on the MTBBS, and then please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you very much. I'm Gretchen Humphries. I'm the Deputy General Secretary of the second largest trade union federation in the country. Representing in excess of 520,000 members. And after our merger, which is due to happen in the next 2 weeks, it will grow to 800, so that's a significant number of members of this group. Our comments on the 2010 budget will, as normally we do every year, will focus on the broader perspective of government budget. I will mainly stick to the position that is in submission. I will not be doing a PowerPoint presentation because I think the clear aspects are in our submission. It's quite a long submission, so I won't be going through it word by word, but just highlighting the key areas that we feel is important as such. In our comments on the budget, we will focus from a broader perspective on the change in government economic policy and the fiscal policy against the background of the deep recession and what the experience in terms of economic policy goals, growth, inflation, employment, and income distribution. For us, it's particularly employment is very specific, and growth within the employment sector is key to anything in the budget. What's very clear in terms of 2010 budget and the budget review studying the document is there's a clear, very sense of a resource-based environment in the present environment, and therefore one has to address your estimates very clearly in terms of how that stands. I would like to focus on the South African policy approach first. There are wide-ranging differences in government regarding the role of government specifically in the economy, ranging from your leftist approach, implying a greater role for government and a higher budget deficit, to a more free market approach. And it can be deduced from this that the different elements contained in the economic policy in this year's 2010 budget. The minister would not deviate much from the government's policy framework adopted in the 1996-year policy framework. Without going into directly referring to GEAR or going into much deliberation on that, GEAR adopted in 1996 had some shortcomings. it was accepted that it served the country well, it brought down the inflation rate, it lowered budget deficits, and also more money was available for social expenditure. And it also normalized the capital, foreign capital outflow by improving our credit rating. There are some critical elements that must be included in any macroeconomic policy framework. Namely, you've got to look at things like the effective cost of labour, the productivity of public investment, and the efficiency of your public service delivery. A post-year economic policy that you're currently in needs to engage with the factors that lead to the expansion of business, the management of skills within the public sector, the rising employability of young people specifically, and the ability of the economy to sustain its relative global resilience. These areas, or success in these areas, will define whether or not your state is developmental, and we're currently discussing the movement of South Africa into a developmental state and the critical characteristics and elements that need to be carried in order to get to that. One also needs to ensure that you're globally competitive and that you accelerate poverty eradication. Some elements of this are also contained in previous budgets, but in this year's budget specifically, there is a shift to include some of these elements, specifically the success of the economic policy, the capabilities of the state infrastructure, the effectiveness in policy development, the coordination and the implementation thereof. Producer agree with the elements of the policy approach. What is missing, however, is that the strategy needs to be formalized and discussed by business and labor through the NEDAP process. The GEAR strategy was from the beginning criticized for its not being an inclusive process, but rather a top-down process. And we do hope that with the new... what's important is that the strategy, when GEAR strategy was accepted in 1996, as a public finance and monetary policy chamber within NEDAC, there was a specific request that we need to discuss some of the policy elements. This is basically being boycotted in a sense from the Treasury over the last couple of years. And what we believe now is we're looking on a new economic growth path, and we need to discuss these issues within the various constituencies with government to get a greater acceptance of the economic policies and the new road that we're taking in terms of economic growth as such. And therefore, we need to have a very inclusive process, which is not a top-down process. In terms of the new growth path that needs to be delivered, it's got to be economic growth and decent employment for all. One's got to look at that in terms of the policy. So do you support the proposal of practical macroeconomic policies that will promote environments that are conducive for investments and full and productive decent employment? Through your low and stable inflation and interest rates, a competitive exchange rate, and other measures to encourage financial stability. The social partners in government, organized labor, business, and community constituencies need to develop jointly a new growth path for our economy to ensure that there is massive job creation specifically for the unemployed youth from the age 18 to 24, and not just merely through your public works program, but we need to come up with other measures. We would like to suggest that the new growth path for Africa needs to be developed and include all of the above mentioned elements and formalized through a very consultative process. We engage on these issues, and we're hoping that with the new budget structure, the consultation structure, that we will have some input in terms of that. The announcement of the National Planning Commission, on which we made our comments last year, will also play a very important role in terms of government's vision of the economic strategy. We're slightly disappointed the minister in this year's budget speech did not mention more about that and look at the shift in the budget strategy, specifically pertaining to the Planning Commission and what the role of the Planning Commission in terms of that would be. When we look at macroeconomic development and policy, the IMF made in 2008 made certain statements and proposed that in certain financial climates, one needs to look at the implementation of fiscal stimulus to such as expenditure increases, that across a broad range of sectors, looking at emerging countries to provide support for growth and firms and such. Producers have the opinion that economic policy makers corrected in this, acted in the correct way by the crisis, by way of counter-cyclical monetary and fiscal policy. The system of the multi-year budget planning that was a few years ago actually assisted us in this process. And government spending over the 3-year period basically stabilized, and it had that effect on the economy. It however also implies that when revenue is falling, that your budget deficit must rise as a result of that. There's some tax relief to the private sector. These are some of the options that government has had to consider, and a smaller increase in terms of government expenditure. Producer would argue that we cannot defend all these steps on basis of efficiency grounds or on equity. A combination of tax cuts and expenditure increases would most probably be easier reversible than cuts on expenditure. The fact that there's no reduction in taxes we use implies there's not a lot of maneuverability in this instrument or in the budget. Important lessons is basically to learn that when there's deep recessions in an economy as we currently have, first of all, the role of your financial institutions and then the statistics to help uphold the demand thereof is very important. And what we see in the first lesson is that prudent financial management is crucial to for the avoidance of your recession. And secondly, we've got to uphold total demand. In South Africa, we had the Credit Act being implemented. It undoubtedly contributed to avoid the recession developing into a depression, and therefore prudent fiscal measures were applied to such. As a result of that, we expect that economic growth rate will be nearer to 3% for the year 2010 and 4% for 2011. We estimate that expenditure would slightly be higher, or revenue would be slightly higher in terms of that. We've made some comments on page 6 and 7, specifically on the macroeconomic projections of government, which I'm not going to deal into detail, but I think it's important to note that. In terms of the inflation rate, producers are of the opinion that there are some risks involved due to the oil price and the sudden weakening of the exchange rate. Also, the proposed price hike in electricity is a very uncertain factor. The 24.8% electricity hike is going to have a major effect on SMEs and job losses in the country. Our main concern as producers is to ensure that we have job creation and that we prevent job losses. But we are concerned about these large electricity effects and what it will have in over the years. In the 1990s, we saw a neglect of investment in infrastructure development, but as a public we have the advantage of lower tariffs. The proposed hike would be unaffordable to many businesses and then specifically to your poorer individuals in the community. Producers of the opinion that we're very disappointed that in the budget there were no innovative measures to try and address this. We have made some submissions to NERSA in this regard. We also believe that we should look at the review of NERSA's mandate and the role of NERSA and the rest of interest that there might be in terms of this and such. In terms of the economic policy stance, we want to commend government in a clear way in which development of the macroeconomic strategy beyond the crisis is set out in the budget document. But it's a lot easier said than done, obviously. We've got to ensure that there's fiscal solvency and price and financial stability. Then in terms of the budget deficit, we believe that government should bring down their budget deficit to a more acceptable level. Producers of the opinion that it would not be easy, given the weak prospects for economic growth over the next couple of years. To bring down the deficit would mean bringing down expenditure and increasing taxes, although the minister indicated that tax hike is not from the card. It's mentioned in the 2009 NCDPS that there will be tax increases. And unfortunately, it's those of us that are working that are going against to be affected by this. And therefore, as a workers' organization, organisations or adult areas that are concerned by. In previous budget inputs, we urged government to dovetail fiscal and monetary policy, and we want to commend government on the well-timed coordination of the two policy instruments. In terms of monetary policy, there has been much debate on inflation targeting and the expansion of the mandate of the Reserve Bank to increase the narrow mandate of the bank to also include growth as a target. The Minister reaffirmed that the Reserve Bank will continue its current independent role and continue with the target range policy of between 3 to 6%. In terms of the new budgetary approach to transform the economy, producers are obviously interested in all aspects of the budget that affects workers during their working life and also after retirement, because that's the money that they've worked and earned for in their working life. We're pleased with the many positive developments in this budget to improve the employability and the development opportunities for workers. The only viable and sustainable way to eradicate poverty is by providing job opportunities out there. During the last couple of months of recession across the world, we had huge job losses. In South Africa alone, about 7% of workers have lost their jobs. And these job losses were mainly in the private sector and small businesses as such, whereas the public sector has seen a significant growth in terms of jobs. Household poverty also declined, the unemployment rate remained high, and new entrants into the labour market found it very, very difficult to find employment. A lot of the budget review has been allocated to discuss a new growth and development role through sound macroeconomic policy, and there's also a number of potentially significant interventions aimed at addressing unemployment. To do so, agree with the instruments and the goals being such as the youth development subsidies, labour-intensive industries through the industrial policy action plan and development thereof, skills development, public employment program, and a rural development strategy. One also has to look at the improvement of the state, the effectiveness of the state, particularly the provision of quality education and training at all levels. If we want our economy to grow, we need to ensure that there are skills available to everybody in the country. We also look at the stable exchange rate, providing a buffer against global volatility. We've got to raise productivity and competitiveness, and these are issues that we as workers feel are very important when we're talking to workers on the ground level to deal with these. And to say to workers, you need to work to ensure that productivity is up there. So it's very important for us to do that. We've got to cut the red tape. We've just got to enforce competitive laws. We've got to enhance regulatory oversight, improve the performance of the state-owned enterprises. Our state-owned enterprises are being bailed out all the time and they're not performing as they should. Clearly, there should be some measures put into place for that. We've got to open up the economy to investment and trade opportunities that can boost exports, for example. These are a key element that we believe in a new growth path is very important. We have, in several submissions on the budget, proposed that government take a more proactive role in the economy, not by directly entering the production process. The proposed youth employment program in terms of the wage subsidy is one of those examples. Unemployment, specifically among the youth, is currently among highest. We welcome this, specifically for first-time workers, and the real resources for the proposed industrial policy action plan are two of the interventions which are put into place for that. On the 3rd of March, we'll be doing submissions on the industrial policy action plan specifically and focusing on those aspects and the impact that's got on job entrance to the market. In terms of the expanded public work program, I'm not going to deal with that in a lot, only that we believe as a country we should be aiming at larger, long-term, sustainable jobs for future generations to be reaping the benefits. Having a job for a period of 6 months and then being without an income for the next 2 years, for example, those are the type of scenarios that we want to avoid in currency. And currently that's what's happening within the expanded public works program. Also the development in the state-owned enterprises. Government needs to be firm with state-owned enterprises. We've had bailouts in the past at USA, and then we've got bailouts in this budget of DPSA, Eskom, SABC, last year in the NCBBS, we commented on the SABC, but Bala, for example, they failed management, and it cannot continue on this farm. It's costing us a tax base in the country as a whole. So this is concern that many of our state-owned enterprises are also operating with acting CEOs, and we have witnessed large packages are being paid out for those that are retrenched. Why should a CEO of a state-owned enterprise be getting millions of rand in payout packages? They didn't perform. That's as simple as that. Are we paying for non-performance at this stage? I mean, clearly these are issues that we as producers feel are very strongly that we need to address. It's got to be efficient and effective public service, for example. The bells and whistles in the different departments need to be cut. We are getting invited to meetings with different departments, and we are getting lavish food and venues, etc. These things need to be cut. That's why you cut this. Give them a snack with you and some sandwiches, for that matter. But cut on your basic expenses in terms of that. We've got to reduce corruption. We've got to focus on efficiency and service delivery. We would like to see that at our clinics, for example, that mothers and children are helped, not having to wait there for the whole day to be seen. You're sitting there for the whole day, getting a little slip, and you have to come back the next day to be serviced. Those are the type of service delivery that we need to address, because we've got the allocations in terms of this. We've got to look at educational attainment. What is our education level? We've had discussions with our specific trade union, SAOU, for example, in the education budget, looking at life expectancy, looking at education levels. The Auditor General's report on the audit outcomes of national and provincial departments indicates that the majority of departments are struggling to meet the requirements of the BFMA. It also suggests that financial management quality may have deteriorated rather than improved. These things are obviously of concern when you deal with budgets because it's got a financial implication. There's a new approach to economic development and the idea that one has got to lead by example. Good administrative and managerial skills are required. You've got to develop a performance culture where people are held accountable for their actions. You've got to see management by growth and consumption, expenditure, and better value for money at the end of the day. We also looked at social security. Social security is a safety net for the most vulnerable, and it's coming into the budget in various aspects. There's the Road Accident Fund levy and the proposed bills on this. There's draft legislation on retirement. There's specifically your grants that have been allocated, and we welcome the grants. On that, the Road Accident Levy, the no-fault system that's proposed by the Department of Transport. As producer, we're raising serious concerns, for example, regarding the implementation of the policy and the continued bailout or money that's allocated in the budget to the Road Accident Fund. Do yourself a favor and go and visit the office of the CEO of the Road Accident Fund and see the way in which they spend money on staff training, things that can be done in-house, for example. And those are all things that are effective. One's got to look at your salary bill. If your salary bill excludes more than 50% of your annual budget, then there's obviously some concerns, because that's not what your money is intended for. It's a social safety net, a social security provided for people involved in accidents, for example. Effectiveness does not only depend on the financial position, but also on the effectiveness on the administration. That's something that we would like to stress in this budget, very important. In terms of retirement and health systems, there's an inter-ministerial committee chaired by the Minister of Finance. They need to allow greater public participation on the social security and retirement industry reform than what was done in the past. The wage subsidy is one of the issues that I mentioned here. And in 2009 budget, the Minister indicated that there would be an engagement with NEDLAC on the implementation challenges. We've had two meetings, and we have not been able to significantly address those challenges. Reforms and implementation thereof has been a snail's pace, and we need to address those matters in order to address unemployment. We once again appeal to the Minister and the Interministerial Committee to engage with social partners to ensure that the system that is effectively addressing the shortcomings of the current social system to make provision for proper retirement provision is safe and healthcare is in place, and we can start to take some of the burden off the state coffers and the national revenue. In terms of the tax proposals, largely we welcome the tax proposals. as well, obviously contribute to savings in the country. The positive effects of the tax relief on the economy will help more less, however, be cancelled out by increasing the excise duties and the fuel levy of 25%, and now again by our electricity hike of 24.8%. In terms of the budget closing, we welcome the monetary evaluation of the budget by Parliament and civil society as a whole. We've been calling for these processes for the last 10 years, and we hope that we will be able to analyse and review the budget and the implementation on the policy through this mechanism. Finally, the benefits of the lower budget deficit and even a budget surplus in the 2007-2008 fiscal year were wiped out by the deep recession that we saw in 2009. During the last couple of years, it was possible to increase our social spending, although because of the good position of our government's finances. For the next few years, interest on our public debt will be crowding out by social expenditure. And it's very clear we're not out of the rough yet. There's difficult times ahead, and we've got to look at innovative policy measures as proposed by government to move the economy into an employment creation growth path. That's what we would like to see, and we hope to see that by 2012, 2013 at least. Thank you for the opportunity to do this submission. We're not economists, we're merely trade unions, giving you our view of what we feel is important to the workers in the country. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Amplis, the Officer Lisa, and their strong views. That is actually the role of Parliament to also to listen to the people out there. Honourable members, we've received now the submission of the FFC and the DUSA. There's no time for questions, discussions. We must also look at our time. We started a bit late. Please introduce yourself when you ask your question, also for the benefit of the dissenters. I've noted George.
On your remarks on the role of Parliament in
And I'm asking a question. I'm not sure whether to both the centers or to ourselves or to myself. But I was intrigued by the comments made by Mr. Kumal of the CAF and ACO in the presentation of Ms. Humphrey on what is out of control. The bailouts are not taken within a policy framework of parliament or government. It's the BSA, it's the IDC, it's helping out what is existing and what is in trouble. The non-performing state-owned enterprise, the bonus, and I've heard complaints raised from all quarters in parliament, and there is agreement that something needs to be done, and people look at parliament as those who should do something. Now we have finally the means of the legislative means of intervening in the budget, and it's most powerful means in any parliament which utilizes, because basically says I'm not going to give you the money for this very thing. So my question to both presenters is, in practical terms, what would you want us to do as the finance committee and as standing committee, as we approve the budget, as we apply our mind to the power that we now have of amending the budget to address your concerns? If you were in our booth, where would you put the pen? What would you strike out from the budget to send the message to government that these issues, which have been discussed for so many years, now must be attended to? Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Liang, morning to everybody. My apologies for coming in. Started to be in other places. It's one issue is on the presentation of the FFP page 5 under the macroeconomic outlook, where the test collected for a stable fiscal environment of years will have to, one, reduce or defer spending, and then improve efficiencies and cautiously raise deficits. But my question that I want to ask from FSC is with regard to the notion that was actually presented by Treasurer, to say there will be no wisdom on the part of government to suspend service delivery as a response to the recession, and that you cannot postpone service delivery. You can rather borrow for service delivery. So now, if I can maybe interpret this notion that has reduced or deferred, it means the road that you were going to construct today, you are saying construct this road in the next financial year, let's say. Then what would be the condition and the cost? So that's my issue to FSC. And also, the question of the infrastructural decay that exists in the rural provinces, like the Eastern Cape, especially in the Transkei area, where there hasn't been a dedicated budget to address the legacy of the past in terms of the infrastructure. Right now, 70% of water provision challenges is around leakages. That is the rotten infrastructure that exists there. And then can we really say, let us defer spending on these issues? Can I get more information on that?
Thank you. To the honourable member, we noted that and we'll take that up in the NCP as well.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Sizani. My first question to the old clarity will go to the FST. And they maybe one is to start by appreciating the time given by the two presenters to come and give their own understanding of our budget and their analysis. We really appreciate that. And I have a question that we try to ask is not that they're interrogating, but we'd like to get even more clarity how do they arrive to whatever analysis. Now, to the FSC, I understand that you do appreciate that the minister did indicate on the economic stability. But however, you think that it will take us for so many years up to 2015 to be back to the normal path. It's more on the same paragraph which was referred by Dr. George. Now, what factors do you use that have led you to that decision? And then you also indicated that it was right for the minister to include in his speech that increase in service costs, but however, the FSC is saying take cautious of the personnel expenditure. This is what the FSC is saying. Take cautious of the personnel expenditure, but at the same time, ensure that you cushion poverty. How do you, what model that we can advise the minister to use so it's a feedback? Because it's very good, but to me it's more of a theory. What model? Maybe you do have a model, and we'd love to know, because really if we're saying we need to reduce on the services cost, we need to ensure that we take care of the personnel expenditure, and on the other side we're saying we need to create jobs and we need to alleviate poverty. So how do you balance that? If you can just give us a model. What is in your hands regarding that? You also indicated that there's going to be a negative, there is going to be a negative impact to the rest of the world globally for South Africa on the credit rating if the fiscal risk is becoming worsened. I don't know how to arrive at that, because if you look globally, I think we are among the six in the whole world that we're trying to maintain this recession. So if you can just assist us maybe for other information that you don't have. The last one from the FCC is that you indicate that the contingency liability can spiral into future losses, so we need to properly manage it. What factors can we use to ensure that we manage it, but at the same time we achieve our microeconomic objectives, which is unemployment, poverty, additional poverty, and inequality? What can we use? What factors can we use to seduce us? You have reflected that the 2010 budget did not differ from the 2006 year objectives. Do you think that is bad? Or do you think we should actually change and do something? Can you elaborate on that? And the strategy that was rejected by the Treasury, well, I said repeat because I didn't hear it well. It needs inclusivity. What is this inclusivity? Because I know that you conduct the hearing. Maybe there are other people that we omit, that we don't conduct, or we don't include, we don't consult with them. What is it? What is your makeup on that? What do we need to do? And then we need also to take other measures to ensure that you provide more youth employment. As a union that is so big in the country, I think we would love to know how much of this have you pushed to the private sector, because it's the private sector that is actually not accepting our youth because they do not have an experience. Their CVs are not marketable. So how much have you as a union have assisted the government to achieve that? Because we have tried to ensure, if you have listened to the minister's speech, we have seen that he has actually, they did start a tax reduction to whoever is employing for, whoever will provide the ownership for the post-matriculant students. Last year is the presenter talks about economic stimuli by increasing expenditure, but he says that other side, keep inflation low, striving for the stable and for competitiveness. And then what is then going to bring down the deficit to accept the level. I'm a bit confused in that if you look at the revenue, you collected 22.7%, and you look at the expenditure, which was sitting at 33%. So we are having this deficit. Now, how on earth? Maybe you've got some other letters, and it's very critical if you know about them. Because really, how do we lift ourselves from minus 6.2 and like what the FSC said in 2015, we are back to the normal class. How do we do that? Because there's a marriage between those three letters, expense and education, and how do the community can advance better? Thank you.
Thank you.
We must take an advantage of the fact that the government has made a clear on the call for all of us stakeholders to participate on matters of government, but also to ensure that as we identify gaps, we are also able to make some recommendations on how to deal with those identified gaps. And that's something that I'm missing in some of the issues or gaps identified by the people. Starting with the first presentation, on page 6, obviously, as we all agree that the increase in the public sector wage is an issue that we must manage appropriately going forward. But what I mean from the FSC is what are the individual approach to this issue? I think it will assist a lot if we are able to get to know the position that the FSC would like the government to adopt dealing with this matter. And I hope this might find its way in the process of policy making. And the second thing on what I'm saying here is that FSC is suggesting that we need to manage a part of cost of dealing with aspects of the macroeconomic outlook, managing the increased public sector wage. Now, what I'm missing is how, the how part of it. What is the FSC's advice or position on this matter? And then on the PEDUSA made a submission that indicates that obviously with the increase on the electricity price, this might impact negatively, of course, on the aspect of economy. But the other side also is quite incorrect, because if we don't have the expansion of the electricity infrastructure, we might also end up not performing well economically. Because we need this expansion for sort of growth. So, what I'm missing here is what are the innovative methods that they are carrying to? And are they viable? I mean, compared to, I mean, the approved approach. And also, I mean, have they been communicated appropriately, I mean, to the government? Thank you.
Thank you. One more member.
Your input. From your presentation, I read a silent message that FSC feels that government is borrowing to fund the current account instead of a capital account. If I'm correct, I would like you to elaborate further into how to come to my second question, Chair, is on the proposed fiscal pact to manage the debt level of our government. How do you see that working?
Thank you, Honorable Harris. We have a chairman.
Thank you, Chair. To the FSC, on page 6 of your full report, you refer to setting clear fiscal rules pertaining to debt in a crisis. Surely the major problem with that argument is that the fiscal rule pertaining to debt in a crisis 2 years ago, or a year ago even, would have been very different to that fiscal rule now. My second question is, on page 9 of that document, you speak about the pressure on sub-national governments and therefore provinces and municipalities, and the fiscal pressure on those levels of government. And you talk about the policy responses that would need to be undertaken include raising tax revenue, reducing or deferring expenditure, and improving spending. But the last two, I agree with. But is the FSC seriously saying that if one of the provinces announced a provincial tax at this point, you would believe that to be appropriate in the current economic climate? And then lastly, on page 15 of that document, the discussion of contingent liabilities linked to mainly the increased guarantees to parasitical. Do you have a threshold level or a rule of thumb? The level of contingent liabilities could reach or should reach. And then a quick question to the producer. When your, I don't know what you call them, your sister organization, the larger union, was asked about his opinion, or the head of that union was asked his opinion on the budget. He said he slammed the idea of wage subsidies, calling it a wage subsidy for bosses, said employees should be celebrating tonight. And that union has always objected to a wage subsidy. I'd like to hear your comments on their position and why yours are different. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Harris. Any other member would you take this round of questions, responses, and then we'll take tea. Honorable Machida.
Thanks, Jefferson. I don't have a lot, and I just wanted to share with the FSC. I just want to know, because it looks like we are questioning the issue of borrowing for consumption, whether it is an advice to government that we should not borrow specifically to finance consumption. I just wanted to know on that specific one. And the tax relief, that we have to individuals, whether there is any wisdom in government to grant this tax relief under these circumstances. Let alone that tax relief sometimes are granted to actually stimulate expenditure. But is there any wisdom at this particular time for this tax relief to be granted? Then the guarantees, I'm sure, just maybe to make it more clear to what Honorable Harris has said. At what level would guarantees start posing a risk to government? I think if I can just get some explanation to those ones, I'll be able to tell.
Thank you, Honorable Mashir. Any other questions? None? Tomorrow, if you come in, you can reply.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you for another member for the long question. Okay, I said at the beginning, my colleague from Midland that might actually come in to respond to some of the questions. But I think let me start with the question from I think it's about three people that. Let's talk about that question around the guarantees and where we must think we need to say beyond this. I don't think that the issue is what level are you looking at. What we're saying is there is always a danger of guarantees being perceived as bailout. So basically, it's the environment, it's the environment and the framework within which guarantees can or cannot be guaranteed, and for what purpose. So you need to have certain conditions, basically very tight conditions attached to those guarantees, and so you can't. Take it like as a paintbrush kind of an approach where you paint everything the same. There are certain instances where those are actually necessary because maybe the purpose for that basically would be that would benefit from future generations. It's lending somebody money indirectly, basically. So if it's as a result, for example, of very bad choices. You don't give a guarantee and then keep the same people, for example. You might want to say that. So it's just a tight framework that we're asking for these guarantees. That is very transparent so that everybody knows conditions that are necessary. So I can't actually say what the optimum level would be, because it's really a proper complex kind of question. Because then we're saying that we're treating everything equally, and I don't think that's the correct way of doing it. Now, just let me also respond to the question on the need for the 3 years basically to assist in dealing with the crisis that we have now. I think you know, sometimes PowerPoint presentation tends to hide a lot of what we want to say. We try to say things in as few words as possible. But here, basically, what we're saying is, when we say that reduce or defer spending, we are saying on projects that basically are not priority types of projects. No one is suggesting in any way that we deal with this problem of the budget deficit or trying to get out of the crisis by deferring spending on public services. And I will even go on and say on basic services. You need to increase the rollout of those basic services, but you need to also do it in an efficient, effective manner. That basically at minimum cost, you have to be doing this. So there is generally an awareness that government has tended to do things the expensive way. I think we have had so many stories here in Parliament from Treasury officials, from the Minister of Finance, around procurement, for example, procurement processes where you might find that it costs 7 million to build some school in one area, a classroom, and in another area, the same classroom cost you 60-80 million. I mean, this is a number that has been thrown about that have to do with the way government conducts its business in the delivery of services. So what we're saying by sparing and reducing spending, we're saying we defer spending on projects that are not a priority in terms of what government must do in an environment like this. We're also saying reduce spending on unnecessary and reduce waste basically in the way in which you spend. So I think that is what you're saying. Now, to link that to the issue around succession from Mr. Harris, I think the point is provinces are allowed by the constitution and legislation which was passed by the US Parliament to actually impose taxes as government. And so if a province were to table a tax that is allowed by we have to look at it. Do we have rules on what our tax burden is supposed to be? It has to be looked at in accordance with that. So I wouldn't say that there's anything wrong with supporting a province that comes up and says we want to impose a tax. If that tax does not impact on our macroeconomic aggregate and is consistent with the criteria that it must be evaluated accordingly or according to, we wouldn't necessarily say no to that. It's an issue that one wouldn't want to run away from because it's there. Now, with respect to why we are saying we might not get back to our original trend, which was our pre-crisis trend, and where we're getting those conclusions from, honorable member, we have our own model, basically in the commission that we use. We use the same set of numbers. Probably our model with different assumptions from the National Treasury's assumption. So we have our own model, and the model that we use specifically for this one is a computable general equilibrium model, which basically looks at the economy in its totality, and we can then do some simulation and make certain assumptions about what happens when one shock the economy, a shock like the recession that we had, basically would generate a set of numbers. And so we make sure. Now that is not to say, and I think when one looks at what government's own projections look like and trends, you would basically find that the differences are not that big, but they are differences, and they are as a result of the different sets of assumptions that we use. And so what is important really is the trend rather than the numbers themselves. So that's where we get those conclusions. In the issue around credit rating and worsening fiscal risk, what we are saying is not that as South Africa we are in a very bad position. I think we must accept that the policies that we took or the fiscal policy position that government took in the past 8 years or so was partly the reason why we were able to cushion ourselves far much better than any of the other economies in our position in the world. And that is the reason why we are actually in the top six is because of those successful policies that we took. And so what I'm saying is we need to basically maintain those types of positions in difficult times and take those difficult decisions so that we're able to maintain those kinds of positions. If we relax and say we are number six, so we can do this and whatever, we might actually slide into the principles of this work, and I don't think that's where we want to go. Now, the issue around cushioning poverty, we're talking about a crisis, falling revenue, and how we then balance that. I think it's an issue that goes beyond. If we have in South Africa quite take is to try and ensure that we consolidate that, probably by trying to deal with our education system. It's not about money, we know. It's about improving the quality of education and empowering people and enabling them to go into the job market, aligning our industrial policy strategy, for example, what has been tackled in the past week around that, is an attempt in one side of how you can then realign your education system and allow people to empower people through education to get the right jobs. I think that is what we're talking about. So we're not talking about putting more money to pushing people from poverty. And how do we manage? I think it's a very difficult question. How do we manage the increases in public sector wages? I don't think that the Commission will have an answer to that, because this is a bargaining process and it's centralized in South Africa. And so something has to happen at that level, at the centralized bargaining level, that basically makes the unions and the employers aware of what the consequences of different agreements and arrangements and when and how they're implemented basically imply for our broader macroeconomic environment. Borrowing to fund current account as opposed to capital account. I think what we say is that one has to dismantle that debt and look at what is causing the increase in debt service costs. Now, if there's no cost, then we must actually do something about it. It's not very conclusive, because we haven't actually looked at the numbers, but there is a feeling, basically, in the Commission's work that also has something to do with it. Now, the extent to which that means is something else. In terms of the fiscal rules, I think we spoke about the need to actually have those fiscal rules. And I agree with you, Honourable Member, that fiscal rules would not apply all the time. Same fiscal rules, there have to be a certain degree of flexibility that's built in, that responds to economic cycles. But when you have those fiscal rules, then you are able to interact with the system in a more transparent manner, so you are able to deal with the problems there. I think the issue around Dr. George, you asking about whether or not we think 2.3% is a credible forecast. I don't know whether I can answer that, but let me ask you probably are closer to those numbers than that.
It's difficult to say whether it's realistic or not, because obviously we're using different assumptions in the model. But, our model of projection was that this economy should be growing at 3% in order to grow at the level at which the MTBP has been placed. I think at the time, Treasury has actually projected 4%. But it has been adjusted the growth projection down to 2.1%. So it's a tough call, because of obviously the different assumptions that we make. And that is why we say maybe probably we need some kind of independent evaluation of the assumptions, so that we are independent when we make this kind of projection.
Chair, I have addressed the question from the one that I need.
Thank you.
know what cost is in the kind of money. One also has individual implementations for performance contracts, how those are done. Why are CEOs taking institutions to court when there's CCA banks? And then the notice of CCA taking place for them, for example, what are the disciplinary procedures and the disciplinary costs? Those things need to be provided, but the CCMA that are there, they provide that provision. So labor force is only there to be utilized when there's retrenchment and there's serious problems attending to that or automatically unfair dismissal, for example. So those provisions need to be utilized. And so we look at the personnel codes, the HR codes, the operational expenditure for that. That is also taken as a part by another honorable member in terms of the performing itself in those situations. We've got to look at management and administration thereof. The extensive CEO expenses. Whenever there's a new CEO, for example, the road accident fund, whenever there's a new CEO, first thing they do is very service the office and use it. They're getting computer equipment, for example. We're going to be very glad because we are saying we see those are things that are not supposed to happen. And we need to ask questions as a committee to tell you that. And what is the luxury vehicle for that? Why do you need BMW X5 to do site visits on the road accident fund? You can use a planned bucket for example for that. A 2.4 or 2.5 kg bucket would be fine for that provision. You do not need to go because they hardly go off road apart from a fossil. So those are the answers that we need to look at. We've got to look at operations, we need to get that out of control. So we need to start generating some finances. They've got to be generating finances, outsourcing and training. Why is training outsourced? Why is training not done in-house? Review of the performance contracts of the performance review of the human resource practices, for example. Look at the balance sheet, look at the expenses. Then in terms of the question pertaining to very difficult, the year objective, 2010 budget and 1996 year objective economic strategy. We believe that one of the groups that are not called, for example, to be hearing is a committee where we serve on, for example, the Public Finance and Monetary Policy Chamber, who sits at NEDLAC, for example. We are deciding on these negotiations are done on various goals and various legislation before it comes to Parliament, for example, at that level. You have high level discussions of industry discussing monetary policy and finances, for example. You need to have subpoenas in terms of that as well on these policy matters. One probably get more youth employment, specifically incorporating the policies of the private sector in terms of agreement. But you specifically, we've got an agreement with state, which is an agreement specifically on labor growth. We understand we need to regulate labor growth. We would like to see that, and we're getting the returns in areas where we've implemented that, for example. Specifically on youth employment, we're also serving on the PNSA, and that's the skills. Advisory Council and the Senior Council dealing with skills levies involved in policy reviews at various levels, getting input on that, writing some legislation actually in some areas, and also looking at that, for example, in terms of the input that needs to be given for your economic policy strategy. In terms of the fiscal stimulus and expenditure, it's a very difficult debate. How do you lift from interest rates, inflation, efficiency, expenditure? How do you balance it? You've got to keep some balance. Currently, we're in a huge crisis with having specifically a huge amount of poverty. In this poverty, you've got to look at public expenditure, and you've got to spend more money to overcome it. So we need to devise how to overcome the poverty and the inequality that we have in order for us to come to the aspects. So it's a very difficult debate. But I think we need to entertain that and we need to look at us for the committee. Obviously, we've not answered, but tax cuts, for example, is another area where you can bring stability into your economy, and maybe that's going to be in the final step. In terms of the gaps, in terms of the electricity We let all you all know in Africa. And we're all Africans, but at the end of the day, why should we be paid for electricity, for example, and so on, and so on? Those are things that we need to consider and look at. We started the opinion on the waste side, started allowed to have their own opinion, and we agree on different stuff issues. However, we believe that the waste stuff is actually consultants involved in the skills and very secret and skills structure where the waste subsidy has been discussed over the last couple of years. The reality is we're sitting with a shortage of skills, new entrants into the labour market cannot go into the labour market, which is simply no job opportunities. Your youth employment fell with 13.6%. We've got 48.3% of entrants to the labour market that are out of work. And obviously now we've got a bit of new measures. Therefore, the wage subsidy is currently an opportunity that exists then to utilise. Obviously, the monitoring and the implementation thereof will be the key aspect to manage. And if it's managed properly in a proper manner, then we should not have the use of the body and so on. However, the report that was done by Mary Metcalf to the Education Committee 2 weeks ago clearly indicated that there are problems in the with the teachers and the management thereof. So we need to look at that as well. You've got to streamline your administration, et cetera, your regulatory framework is to reduce the costs that are associated with employees. So we've got to look at that. You see the short-term measure that we need to look. Short-term measure most probably for two to three years. Thereafter, other measures need to be implemented. And you've got to save your economy and recover your economy.
You done? Thank you. Thank you again to FFC and to Fiducia for the presentation. All the members, we need your cooperation now. We're going to break for tea. 5 minutes. Because we started 23 minutes late, past 9. So, sorry to restrict you, but within 5 minutes, please be back, and then we will go on with the public hearing. We will contribute more detailed submissions when we receive more detail on the budget. We recognize the difficult balance that is required with formulating a budget to address job creation, long-term sustainable growth, poverty reduction and improvement in service delivery in a global economy still suffering from the defects of the economic crisis. We therefore support the notion that the budget proposal should be financed by improved tax compliance, closing loopholes, improved tax administration, and improved, and this is very important, public sector efficiency, rather than increasing personal income and corporate tax. And then we conclude by suggesting a relook at broader policy issues so as to promote coordination between tax authorities in different jurisdictions, and I'll briefly discuss these issues. But our first point, monetary and fiscal policy, we wish to agree there with the Honourable Minister of Finance that the central bank's role should is and should remain the protection of the value of the currency. I believe and hope that we still operate in a free market economy where supply and demand is still a valid principle, and they operate by a pricing mechanism. And this pricing mechanism is highly important to operate unfettersedly in our economy and to ensure that economic decision makers make accurate decisions on which businesses to start and which businesses not to operate. An incorrect monetary policy could lead to a situation where uncompetitive industries are subsidized and entrepreneurial activity stifled. And this we mentioned because we realize the difficult situation that we are in. And I think some of the earlier speakers have mentioned this, a decision to finance certain of our activities via debt. We just need to note this to the honorable members that this path we should tread very, very carefully and in a very considerate manner. We quote there a Nobel Prize laureate, F.A. Hayek, which part of his study indicated that a misdirection of production that could occur in a situation which relies too much on debt financing. According to recent reports, and we quoted the source there, the public sector will need to borrow a 1.1 trillion rand in the 4 fiscal years to 2012. And this amount would need to be repaid. Now, this repayment is dependent on economic growth. Together with an address of expenditure. So So this would mean small increases in public sector salaries, lower growth in government employment, cost savings, and reprioritization of expenditure. If expected growth, and this is the important part, does not materialize, which we are not, some commentators have mentioned that we're not out of the cauldrons yet with the economic crisis and might go into a second dip. So this quote here, I just want to highlight it. If expected growth does not materialize, or government fails to rein in spending sufficiently, we could face higher taxes in future. It is therefore the utmost importance that government stay the course of conservative and disciplined monetary and fiscal policy. Our second point, just elaborate on broadening the tax base. The key point to remember there, or that we would like to share with you, is we believe that the tax base should be broadened and the taxes shouldn't be increased. We've highlighted two graphs for you there, comparing the corporate tax income as a percentage of GDP between the OECD countries and South Africa, and you would see that South Africa surpasses the corporate tax percentage of GDP in comparison. So there's little movement to move on corporate tax to increase that. Personal income, likewise, is very, very close already to the OECD. Couple that with the effect of inflation, fuel increases, electricity increases, and you would see that to increase taxes on personal income tax might not be the best solution. And this position is also highlighted by Minister Pravin Gordhan. We quoted him there by saying that the revenue collections are tight and the government requires more tax revenues. The country's economic state, especially with respect to individuals, must be taken into account, and we believe that it has performed in that manner. We are concerned about the fuel levy increase and do view this as an alternative mechanism used to increase the taxes. However, we are concerned about the effect that might have on the economy, and therefore we urge and support the call for improving the efficiency of the public sector. We believe that savings so generated could reduce the overall tax burden imposed by personal income tax. Our third point, the promotion of youth employment. Just to start off, the Minister of Finance agreed by saying our bargaining arrangements push up entry-level wages, pricing out inexperienced work seekers. And then the budget proposed a subsidy to employers. We support any effort that will assist with long-term sustainable job growth. However, we just like to share a proposal that we found quite interesting and suggest that it should be considered by Eustace Davey from the Free Market Foundation, suggesting that in line with the Minister of Finance's statement that we must do things differently, we cannot do the same old things and expect different results. Highlight his suggestion that every person who has been unemployed for 6 months or more be given an exemption certificate that exempts them from the labour laws for a period of 2 years on condition that there is a written contract. So that will enable such a person, we think, to gain employment and address the lack of employment currently prevalent in our economy. Our point four, tax administration. We support the voluntary disclosure program proposed in the budget speech. However, we would request that such a program be implemented immediately. If the program is postponed until the 1st of November, there might be quite valid reasons for that. It will place the tax practitioner after the taxpayer in a very difficult situation of when he should submit his tax return. We all know and we all agree that tax returns should be submitted on time and there shouldn't be any leniency on that. However, as in the case with all such programs, the timing is important. We would like to see everybody become compliant as soon as possible and hope that that will perhaps be implemented before the 1st of November. We note the Job Tax Administration Bill. We support the core principles of that bill by improving the administration of taxes. It's a well-drafted document. It's clearly drafted. Everybody can understand that document, and we hope. And this is also a core part of our submission to simplify the tax structure, that future tax laws could follow through the example set by this bill. However, we also note significant additional powers given to SARS, which SARS didn't previously have. And those powers are really, really significant in terms of that. We've proposed consideration for a tax ombudsman, an independent body that could assist taxpayers and protect taxpayers against the powers used by SARS. These powers by SARS will be implemented or made effective by individuals, persons like you and I, and mistakes can happen. So we would like to suggest that
did you consider the implementation of a tax on the lastly, and then I'm going to close with that, we did propose some international tax issues. We've included for you a policy paper highlighting certain issues, which you can read later on. I'm just going to highlight two or three of the points made, and that is it also relates to our current decision to increase the debt part of our budget. We suggest government should address national tax rules, which distort behavior and reward one financing route over another. It's important to us that the tax law should promote saving, and from saving, that could be used as equity investments in businesses and would address some of the issues highlighted by the IMF, which exacerbated the economic crisis, and that would have been tax laws, by increasing a disposition for lending, because interest rates on lending are deductible, but if I make an equity investment in a firm, there's no notional cost associated with my equity investment. Firms would prefer more debt, but that would increase their liability, and in the position that we are currently now, we should tread carefully in that area. Then lastly, I just want to suggest, and some of these other points make it very, very clear, that the perception which the taxpayer have of the tax system is important because that influences his compliance. We would therefore suggest an approach which would simplify the tax law, remove all or some of the complexities still prevalent so that the taxpayer can understand and voluntarily comply. We noted that the tax admin bill in some instances would warrant or suggest that the SARS auditors would be armed and go and collect taxes. We believe that in the current situation that we are in, everybody will have is going to suffer, that the economy is very difficult. We will have all to pay more taxes, and we would like to see the taxes being paid on a voluntary basis rather than increasing animosity. We lastly, and this is I'm going to close with, is we suggest that perhaps it could be considered the creation of an independent tax committee to assist in the drafting of tax policy, especially if persons from practice, accountants, could be asked to assist government in drafting tax policy. We could identify areas to simplify the tax laws and make it more understandable. And a more simple tax system we propose would mean more compliance and eventually more taxes. And also a happy taxpayer, if there is such a thing. Then, in conclusion, the Minister of Finance, in his budget speech, stated that our people want government, business, labour and social organisations to work together to create a better economic future. We support this stance and hope that our submission will be seen as part of a collaborative effort to ensure that the lives of all South Africans are improved. I thank you.
Thank you, Minister van Wyk. That was short and sweet. There's a lot of content in the document we received from your organization. We're going to take the next presentation. That will be PricewaterhouseCoopers. Professor Maraji. Professor, welcome. You can come here to the front. And you may proceed.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to be talking directly to the document which I expect being distributed, the one of the photographs is head on it, headed Budget 2010 Tax Proposal. And as the document suggests, I'm going to be focusing not so much on the economics. I think you probably will have and will hear about the economics. I'm going to be focusing essentially only on the tax proposals that came out of this year's budget speech. And I suppose just at the outset, I will make the point that you'll see perhaps my colleague Ian van Wyk and some of the other tax practitioners here before you again in the future, because while this is our preliminary view on some of the proposals, the notorious thing about particularly tax legislation is that the devil's always in the detail. So I might sit here today saying we think something's great, and then when we actually see the word, it turns out to not be so great. And similarly, I might complain about something that we think is objectionable,
And then when we actually see the text of the legislation, we realize it's not so bad. So I do, in typical accounting fashion, want to take that provider up front. Overall, our view is that this was a relatively balanced and neutral budget from the perspective of where taxpayers stand, where were they and where they end up. We don't think it's overly favorable, but certainly not overly harsh as well. It's really a matter of give with one hand and take with the other. We think taxpayers have not been adversely affected, but it certainly hasn't been generous. And secondly, we do also want to use this opportunity to thank National Treasury and SARS for limiting to a large degree the extent of substantial change to the tax landscape. This is the second year in a row now that I'm thanking SARS and Treasury for this. From about 2000 to 2008, we had relentless onslaught of significant change every single year. People were, first we didn't keep up. And now taxpayers and tax practitioners do have an opportunity, an extended opportunity, to understand and properly implement the substantial changes that came in the decades before. So thank you for that. The rest of my discussion is really split up into a few proposals that we would like to applaud and think of clearly steps in the right direction, and then some comments towards the end on issues that we are concerned about, that are headed up the areas of concern. First of all, under my heading of proposals that we welcome, I do echo the applause for the limited amnesty. I think SARS have done a pretty good job of demonstrating to the citizens of the country that they are serious about broadening the tax base. And that it is important for everyone to be included in the tax net. And the amnesty that we had from a few years ago, I think, did contribute to that. But I do think we're at a point now where we can expect, and I think correctly so, SARS to be increasingly harsh. I think that they've given sufficient opportunity. This additional amnesty, I think, sends the right message that for those who do want to be compliant, SARS is there, and they do offer the opportunity for people to come in the tax system without too much of a penalty. I would, however, echo the concern about the delayed implementation date. And I do want to repeat that point. If I was a non-compliant taxpayer today and I wanted to go to the SARS office now and say, I'm sorry, I didn't pay my taxes, can I pay now? There's no benefit in it. It actually suits me, which it actually counts in my favor to stay out under the radar until November when these rules kick in. So I know there might be some systemic issues that might mean it's not that easy to implement this before November, but the delay to November is likely to create a further deal of uncertainty. My second point is the proposal for international headquarters companies. I think this has been a long time coming, and we really do welcome it. The developed world generally does see South Africa as the gateway to the rest of Africa, and for many reasons we are positioned correctly as that. But exchange control and tax have traditionally been obstacles. Again, we haven't seen a lot of detail in the budget documentation, but certainly the comments that were made make it clear that these two issues will be addressed: the relaxation of exchange controls and the tax rules relating to foreign multinationals wanting to come through South Africa into the rest of our northern neighbors. The point about Sharia compliant finance, Islamic finance, again, a very welcome move. We don't have the detail yet, but I think the point was to bear in mind is up until now, we've been pretty excluded with these financial products not really knowing where they stand in relation to product and tax rules, and Treasury's commitment to address it now is welcome. And then the final point under measures that we commend is Treasury's commitment to environmental incentives. I mean, obviously, speaking from the other side of my face in a minute now, I'm going to be complaining about certain things. But at the very least, I'd like to say it's clear that this is high up on the agenda, and correctly so. Whether the measures implemented and the speed at which they are being implemented with leave room for improvement, that's something I will discuss later, but my point for now is we are very grateful that this is so high up on the agenda. Then turning now to some of the negatives and things that we are concerned about, point number one is the comment made about cross-border tax abuse. And I think
again, to start with, this is the focus. So I do want to start off by saying that aggressive tax-scheme to abuse the tax legislation, to abusively avoid taxation, it's entirely appropriate that stars should target those. Our experience, unfortunately, and this is it's clear from submissions that would have been heard in the past years in this chamber, is that the legislation drafters are notorious for applying a blunt instrument where what you need is a very precise scalpel. Right? You have some of these abusive schemes that are quite sophisticated, and they should be attacked. But my question is, what instrument are you going to use? The proposals that come that have been mentioned in the budget are indeed for us relatively scary. For example, we have at the moment in South Africa we have an interest exemption, or sorry, a tax exemption for interest-based foreigners. So a foreigner who invests money into South Africa, they don't pay any extra tax on the interest that they derive, and that applies irrespective of whether that foreigner pays tax in their home jurisdiction or not. They don't pay estate tax, and some of them pay their tax at home, and some of them don't. And what this proposal seems to be saying is that, well, if you are not paying tax at home, then you're going to be paying tax in South Africa. So a multinational, for example, and let me just use an example. So you've got a UK multinational, and they want to invest into South Africa. If they invest directly into South Africa, they will pay UK tax and still not pay any SA tax. But if they decide to structure their operations so that they reduce the UK tax, we're not talking about paying less SA tax, they're just simply reducing their home tax in their home jurisdiction. They want to penalize. So are we saying to these foreign investors, we don't want your money over here? I really do question the wisdom behind this particular proposal there. Only those who pay foreign tax, and I want to make a point, we're not talking about people who are abusing the SA tax. We're not going to increase our SA tax collection with this. We're just penalizing them because they don't pay tax at home. So quite concerned about that. I'm on page 3 in the middle now, moving on to my next point, which is the thing about the formula-based interest allocation. What this is about is for businesses who use borrowed funds to run their operations. For them, a big deal is always how much tax relief can I get for the interest that I incur? I go to the bank and I borrow some money, and I have interest expense. I'm using the money in my business. Can I get a deduction for it? Now, there are established tax principles about when you can get a deduction and when you can't. What this proposal says is, okay, forget those tax principles. We just need to take a broad brush formula approach, and we're going to say, looking at your headline earnings, of your overall income, we're going to do a split of your interest on that basis. Without looking at, well, what did you actually borrow and what specifically did you use the borrowing for? And I do want to make the point that if I borrow 100 rand to use in my productive saving business, and I use 10 rand, and I borrow another 10 rand, to use in an exempt business, and I shouldn't be getting the deduction for that 10 rand, it doesn't make sense, and it's certainly against tax principle, for all of it to be thrown together and to be just allocated on a formula basis. What we are saying here is we turn to basic tax principles, which say, follow the money. If you borrow money, ask the question, what do you actually use it for, instead of just a formula. Coming back to my point about environmental incentives, our concern here is... Okay, no, what I'm proposing is no change. I'm saying do not introduce a formula. I'm saying we've got 100 years of case law and well-established tax principles which simply say you incur interest expenditure. What you need to do is ask the question, what did you use the money for? What did you use the money for? That's the most important question. And that is the established tax principle. What this formula proposal says is, we're not really concerned about what you use the money for. We just need to look at your total income and do a formula for you. Is that a little bit clear? Okay, thank you. Okay. Turning to environmental incentives, I did earlier applaud the fact that this is... appears to be a big deal on Treasury's agenda, and correctly so. We, though, are concerned about the rate of change. How quickly are incentives being introduced, and what are the extent of the incentives? Because the encouragement of responsible environmental behavior requires, in our view, both the carrot and the stick. And so far, we've seen only the stick. We've seen the electricity levy in 2008, and now we are seeing the tax on emissions proposed for this year. In 2008, along with the introduction of the electricity levy, the budget documentation in the same paragraph of the budget documentation made the point that this will be complemented by tax incentives to encourage responsible behavior. Now, our concern here is that these tax incentives have not been coming through. We've seen two proposals last year, one of them, which is of limited application, and the second one, which is still not operative, as well, it's stuck waiting for regulations to be published, to be drafted and be debated. So even though the rules were promulgated last year, but having said that, even if it were to be promulgated, and in effect it is largely inadequate because it doesn't provide the incentive that will encourage people to change their behavior to reduce emissions. So our broad call here is, where are the incentives? There's a lot of talk about encouraging correct behavior, we agree with the use of the stick and increased taxes to some degree, but there should also be incentives for people to go out voluntarily change their behavior. And just, not a smallish point, but the increased taxation of company cars it's not something that I'm really jumping up and down about, but that raises a question mark, because the current company car regime is already such that this is not a huge benefit to employees who have company cars. And let me just clarify that with some numbers. At the moment, if you receive a company car benefit, so the company buys a car and you get to use it for free, you are effectively taxed on 90% of the value of that car over a period of 3 years. That's 30% per year. So it says if you were given the car, or 90% of the car, and you were taxed on it, but at the end of the 3 years, you don't actually have the car. So that is the current position. It's really not such a great benefit, generally, it's not such a great benefit to have a company car, because you are already taxed on 90% of the value of the company car over 3 years. Now, my question is, if we're going to increase that, I'm sorry, let me just take a step back. That's if you have one car. If you get a second car, or more than two cars, then those additional cars are taxed 96% of their value taxed within 2 years, as opposed to the 90% within 3 years for the first car. So my question is, if we're going to increase this, are we just simply, and I suppose here's just a message, I want to be clear on the message, are we simply saying company cars should not exist? And because this is going to turn us into a really bad, bad idea. If I were an employee, and people were to ask me, well, how do you want your salary structure? I would say the one thing I don't want is a company car, because that puts me in a far worse position. I would much rather take the money and pay tax on it and buy my own company car. We're already there now. It's difficult to see how making it harsher will achieve anything except to keep the whole thing up. And then to end off with, there were a few points that were neither negative or positive, but we were concerned by the uncertainty about the finance, and we really wish more would have been said. And I've headed that up under the job method. And the first one is the changeover from SDC to the dividend tax. Now, no one is particularly calling for an acceleration, that, you know, we need to have a changeover this year, or that you need to push it back to 2015. All that the tax paying community is saying is, can we at least have some certainty? When? You know, we had no indication. We were hoping that Minister Gordon would have this year made some kind of comment. All he said this year was that, you know, we're defining it, we're working on it, and that is appropriate, it needs refinement. If I can just go a little bit into the history, Minister Manuel in February 2007 said the dividend tax, the changeover would be phased in over 2007 and 2008. Then the 2008 budget came and they said 2008 and 2009. Then last year's budget came and they said, we think late 2010, and this year we said nothing. So I'm not saying we must have it or we mustn't have it, but can we just have some kind of certainty? And especially foreign investors are asking the question, because they were the ones that had the big problem with SDC to start with. They were very happy that there was going to be a changeover. And the dividend tax to keep in mind, there's a lot of system issues. With companies paying dividends, the way their back office operates, the way they need to account to SARS or the old tax and pay this, the way the cash needs to move in order to be paid over SARS. A lot of things that need to be changed, people need to get paid for that. The second last point there is on research and development. Again, this wasn't specifically addressed, and that is our issue. There's uncertainty about the tax incentives granted to encourage research and development. Those uncertainties are known, they exist. And so maybe there are being jobs in the background, we don't know. It would have been helpful to most investors, especially funders wanting to invest in research and development projects, wanting to know where do we stand, and the silence on that was something we all didn't see this. And then the final point is on industrial incentives. This was, again, a really big deal introduced last year, Section 12I, saying giving very worthwhile incentives to big manufacturing plants. So people coming in here and investing 200 million rand in building a manufacturing plant. It all looks good on paper, but again, it's stuck in the regulations. There are regulations between the Ministry of Finance and the State of Industry, and no one can move because these provisions are not aligned. You can see them on paper, and you can see what they're supposed to do, but they don't have any license in it because they're waiting for the regulations. March 2009, we heard that there were draft regulations, and then signed. So projects are on hold, and we sit here and we don't really know what's going on. So the silence of that is something that we are concerned about. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Maraji, for your input on probably solution. Thank you to the presenters, honorable members. It's time for questions. We have captured some time. But no, respect around that. Just want to note the honorable members, Dr. George. Dr. George, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you very much for the presentation. Very interesting, as usual. The ACCA, I want to ask the question about the tax office. You mentioned that it sounds like a very good idea. Have you done any work on it and have you thought about it? And if you have, would you be able to see some proposals on that? Also, the Independent Tax Committee, also that sounds like a very good idea because the relationship between the taxpayer and the tax man is obviously skewed in a particular direction, and this could well add a little bit more balance. The same question as the first one applies. And then on tax compliance, you mentioned that obviously there is a relationship going on. My understanding that there is some kind of difficulty with regard to tax to VAT collection, that there is a phenomenon known as round-tripping, and that there's a lot of evasion going on there. I'd like to know if you have any comments on that. And then, Professor Mology, I would just also then, while we're on the subject of tax ombud and the Independent Tax Committee, I'd like to know what your view on that would be, because the issue of simplification of our tax system has actually come up before. And then on the proposed changes to the tax, the net impact is about minus 450 million, if I read it properly, doesn't really make much change. But if you look at the macroeconomic framework, and you look at the revenue that is being collected off the tax base, what is your impression of that? Does that number look right? Thank you, Chair.
Well, Michelle?
Thanks, Chairperson. On the first presentation, I think right on page 2, in the second paragraph, so, there is an assertion that in paragraph 3 we are following a free market economy. I just want an explanation what informs that position, because other people have already informed me, whether correctly or wrongly, that we are in a mixed economy. Now, I just want to have an understanding what informs that position of a free market economy in South Africa. And then on PricewaterhouseCoopers, the on the welfare page, point number one, there is an indication that this presentation also represents taxpayers. And I'm not sure whether the presentation is made on behalf of taxpayers or first practitioners. I thought that PricewaterhouseCoopers may be practitioners. I just want to know also what informs you to speak on behalf of taxpayers, whether there is any exercise that you have undertaken to know exactly what are the feelings of taxpayers up to this position in time. On page 2, point 7, this comment looks like, to me, it looks like is based on perception. I just want to check with you whether shouldn't we wait for the details rather than to have this perception, because it cannot be justified by anything other than just through the perception. I think it goes along with your initial view that the devil is in the details, but because we don't have those details now, one is just proposing whether it's not correct to wait for the details rather than to send a wrong message. And then on point 12, on the company card, I just want to know what is the difference on practice when a company gives you a company car or you buy your own car for the time of the use of the vehicle. What is the difference? Because it looks like you are really making serious differences on having an own car and a company car. Because practically, when you have a company car, you don't have limitations. You don't have limitations on the car. You drive it home, and you derive utility on the car, just like on your own car. So I just want to know whether maybe there are differences that I may not be knowing in relation to the use of the car during its lifetime. It's useful time at the level of company operation. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mashire. Any other questions? Mr. Harris, you want to go on?
Thank you, Chair. Three quick questions for PwC. The first one, on your first page, you speak about the relatively neutral effect of the tax proposal. I did a back of the envelope calculation a while ago on the personal income tax, and it seemed to me that despite the fact that inflation was 6% last year, the brackets were only adjusted by around 3%. So what you have is a 3% increase in tax by itself. I'm just wondering, I'm new in the committee, and I'm wondering what the experience has been over the past few years with that. Does Treasury normally always adjust for the whole of the bracket creep? Or do they sometimes do that kind of less than inflation increase to allow real taxes to increase? The second question on page 3, your incentives for the environmental incentives you speak about, can you give us some ideas around the best practice internationally of how such incentives could look? And then lastly, your point 16 on the industrial incentives, do you mind expanding a little bit on, it's quite an interesting point you make that I'm not aware of, on where those regulations need to come from and which acts they're associated with. And you said like publication of regulations, what other factors are also hampering the incentives? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. Swart.
Thank you, Chair, and my apologies for being late due to other commitments. I want to touch on what the previous speaker also referred to, and to both speakers, on the issue of the bracket creep. The Financial and Fiscal Commission refers on page 10, quoting the Star, that the 6.5 billion relief is actually could be a misnomer, that if bracket creep is not, was not taken into consideration, in effect, there would be an increase of 22 billion rand revenue. Would you just comment on that? And I see the Institute of Chartered Accountants refers to the 6.5 billion saying we are of the opinion that this creates a false sentiment, and you refer to the cover line. But I think there's a broader issue here of the lack of addressing bracket creep as referred to by Mr. Harris. So I'd like a comment on that. And then just a second question on the Institute of Chartered Accountants, where you make the comment, and you might have dealt with this in my absence, but you make the comment that we caution that the budget deficit may become a concern in the future if it continues to grow. And that obviously is a huge elephant in the room that we're all going to be sitting on as you consider the fiscal framework. The 1.3 trillion rand debt in 3 years' time, and the fact that debt service costs will be 104 billion rand, and I'd like some further comments on that, particularly considering that the wage bill, which is a current expenditure, is increasing so dramatically. So borrowings is being used not for capital expenditure, or I shouldn't say exclusively for capital expenditure, but also for current expenditure. And if you'd like to comment on that and how one addresses that, clearly to reduce government expenditure, but it is a major concern of us in the committee to increase government public debt, which will reach 40% of GDP in 3 years' time. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Khan.
The first thing I think I would like to thank the two presenters because there are more solutions than maybe criticizing the content of the budget. So much as whether we be able to achieve them, but we have left us with something tangible. Mine goes to ACCM. If we talk about about the realization of the tax controls. Are you saying we are too relaxed, or you are saying it's okay that we have to have the international tax code needs to be more relaxed? Because if now, right now, there is a problem with that, in the sense that our local sector, like the clothing sector, the manufacturing sector, they are feeling this impact of this realization. So if we can just give me a chance, because I could not get it quite good. That's why I just repeat, because I was not getting it. My mind was trying to record it, and then I said, if you can just repeat that for me. Thank you.
Honorable
Mr. Nani?
Yes. Thank you, Chair. Mine is on the general outlook of the budget. Maybe ACCA would be best suitable to clarify this issue. The issue of the automatic inflation management. When we look at the baseline figures of the budget, that is the last financial year's budget, this is the 10-11, is there an indication that says there is an increase in terms of the figures, and therefore there will definitely be a better outcome at the end of the financial year? I'm asking this question, Mr. Sassin, because automatic inflation management is like a diminishing type of growth of budget, where it will grow and not increase at the level where it's supposed to be or it seems to be. Was the price of bread today, next year it will be doubled. So if you get an increase that equals the prices today vis-a-vis the future, Would you say there is an expectation? In fact, it has been created that there is that kind of an expectation that there will be more outcome. But I need the analytical expression Africa of ACTA in this regard, but must we expect much or else we must be able to say in the spending patterns as it has been reflected that we need to be cautious in terms of our spending. We must spend on much on issues of service delivery that are basic, not on issues that are not that important. So in doing so, on the issues that we think are more critical, you must be expect much now. Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions?
Thanks, Chairperson. Not a question. There is something that I did not get right. When the presenter from the ACCA, in one of their proposals, said something like a certificate of exemption from labor law for people who have spent a certain period without employment. I want that gentleman to repeat it and elaborate a bit about it.
Thank you. Mr. Van Wyk, and then Professor Alaji, you can respond to the questions.
Thank you, Honorable Lemon, for all those questions. I can see this is a well-educated and well-led committee, and it's an honor to share our ideas with you. And I hope it will also be seen in this light that we wish to participate and address the very, very serious questions that face each one of us. First of all, I'm just going to start from how I drafted my responses. On the tax omnibus, the idea actually originated, and my colleague just walked in, from the South African Institute of Tax Practitioners. I think they already did some research on this. Our research was more cursory, more at a high level. But the indications are that given the powers given to SARS in the new draft tax administration bill, the tax omnibus is a necessity. The taxpayer or the individual needs to be protected from institutions or entities with more power than that individual has. And we believe the tax ombud can fulfill that role. The main thing is that the tax ombud should act in an independent manner. SARS does have, and these things do work, an SSMO as well as an ADR system. However, these are internal, and we think with the new powers, perhaps we can just discuss the creation of the tax ombud. We will surely give a proposal to this committee if so requested. With regard to the Independent Tax Committee, I'm just going to read from our submission. The intention is not to replace this committee or any other government function. I would not be so bold as to say that, nor do I believe that it's appropriate. It's more of an assistance committee that could give an independent perspective and in an advisory capacity. So in a research paper issued by the ACTA in March 2009, the idea of an independent tax policy setting vehicle was examined. The proposal was that there should be a body of experts separate from government which would be tasked and empowered to formulate and propose, that's important, the word propose, tax policy. In addition, and this is, I suppose, the main function which could be considered, it would also have the express remit to seek to simplify tax systems, which globally are far too complex. Because we realize that we're moving into a very difficult situation. We will need to get more tax from the taxpayer, and this has to be done in a manner that will not upset the taxpayer. And we believe that by SARS joining with certain experts, we could surely come up with a good model. With regard, there was a question on tax compliance VAT collection. VAT collection, there have been many proposals made. SARS is also addressing these issues. We are also part of the National Stakeholders Meeting with SARS, and that has been the topic being discussed at that committee level, so it is something that's continuously being discussed and seen how the VAT collection could be improved. Lastly, the tax base. The point I wanted to make then, if I recall the question correctly, as I have it, and I might be mistaken, but to me, there's three basic areas to improve, to increase, to make money available, to do service delivery and to spend. That would be lowering interest rates and borrowing more. So that would be a debt approach where the state would borrow money and spend. Or there could be an increase in taxes. or lastly, we could broaden the tax base. And I think that is my own perception, that the Minister of Finance in the budget speech opted for the, or put the emphasis on an expansion of the tax base, and we agree with that. Because of the risk, we all saw what happened with the world economy on a too high reliance on debt. If something goes wrong there, you're in the doldrums. If the economy doesn't grow as you expected, you're in serious trouble. Taxes, I gave you the graph there, in comparison to the OECD, corporate and personal taxes is already at the maximum level. We are increasing the fuel levy, we are increasing the electricity level. Somebody has to pay for that. That would also be the individual. So to some regard, it could be considered as a tax being paid by them. So the only option left is the tax base that has to be broadened. But because of this, and because of the situation we are in, we again think of the taxpayer and would love to see the creation of a tax ombud. Because in the expansion of the tax base, individuals will enact an act of parliament, the individual will use judgment, the tax auditor, when he meets the taxpayer, that's a relationship that needs to be governed, and the taxpayer needs to be protected. Then there was a question related to the free market economy. Yes, obviously, anywhere in the world there's a pure free market economy. It's always mixed. It's just, I suppose, the percentages and the relationship between the two. The question of a free market, I understand it, is who owns the means of production. To use a comparison, there's more than 1 million closed corporations registered. I think it's nearly close to 2 million. There's 420,000 private companies registered. There's 400 public companies registered. And I'm not even counting the sole proprietors or the partnerships. And all of them, and I'm sure members of the House, would all, I suppose some would have businesses running closed corporations, private companies. That makes you an owner of the means of production. It gives you a right to private property, to act and to compete and to make profit, and that would mean you operate in a certain free market context. The main point to remember is effectiveness, efficiency, and competition. That's the only way, competition is the only way that, and demand and supply, that we can determine whether the thing we are doing has value. And I suppose this is a difficult part when it comes to public spending. How do we know that what we do has value? And this is something that the committee and all of us need to consider. With regard, I just wanted to make a comment on the question of the environmental factor. Our position paper also has an opinion on that. We see that as a short-term measure because the tax is based to change behavior. Once that behavior has changed, then you lose the tax revenue. So if cars get improved and they reduce the CO2 emissions, they will be less taxed. So it's a short-term measure which will have to be replaced in the future. Secondly, we would like to know where this money on the CO2 emissions will be spent. We would like to see it being spent on improving the environment. There was also then a question on debt and economic growth. I think that is a serious concern going into the future. It is something perhaps for a national debate, solving the issue of the risk that we are taking with this high level of debt and how we will manage it. As our paper suggested, we are dependent on economic growth going into the future. My question to this committee, and I don't have an answer, what happens if we don't get the economic growth but still sit with the high levels of debt? In our mind, it's hard work and saving that solve problems and not necessarily a reliance on debt. With regard, there was one more question. I just need to see what I wrote. I think, just then to summarize, leadership is important. Our focus should be on long-term growth. I've got three little daughters. They will be here long after me, and they will also have children. We need to also look at them. We need to put them in a better position than we are in, and therefore our current decisions will impact them. And I think that principle, I would suggest, should inform the decisions we make with regard to taxes and debt that we incur. There was a question on the certificate of exemption. Just to read again, the Minister of Finance requested that we think outside of the box. The Minister of Finance in his budget speech said that business and government should work together in improving the lives of everybody. So in that sense, we made this proposal. And the proposal is that give a person could apply or receive a certificate that would exempt him from certain of the labor law requirements, so it will be up to that person to decide whether he wants to be exempted or not. That person could then take the certificate and then go and compete on wages with others. So he would say that I'm willing to work for a certain wage. By doing that, he could indicate his willingness to work, his initiative to work, and hopefully be employed. So it shouldn't be seen as an absolute point. It should be seen as thinking outside of the box and putting another proposal on the table. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, as Mr. Van Rijk was saying, quite a few questions. I also think some of them were slightly overlapping, so I'm going to try and address together some of the questions that I thought were overlapping. I hope this seems to be time for anybody to kind of miss anything. Okay. First of all, just on the first point that was made about the trust onwards and those related measures, I'll just very quickly echo the statements that have already been made. Certainly, we exist in an environment already where the administrative powers of SARS are subject to constant criticism. From my correspondence and interaction with the recently departed FMI officer, one of the biggest criticisms against SARS in the administration was that if taxpayers don't stick to the rules, then something bad happens. You know, you end up having to pay the tax and you lose your opportunity to object, or you lose your opportunity to pay the tax. But if SARS don't stick to the rules, then nothing bad happens. So you disagree with your tax law, you have 30 days to object. If you miss the 30 days, you miss the vote. The rules, there are nice rules on paper that says if you do object, SARS has to respond to you within 90 days or whatever the limits are. But the point is, if they miss those deadlines, they just miss it. And they'll come back to you in 2 months. Certainly, under the new proposed tax administration bill, they are given even more far-reaching powers, and we've got adequate examples of them already, but it does require some kind of counseling, so we certainly echo that. As regards the question about the revenue collection and the allocation to various parties, categories of taxes, certainly, in the current climate, it's difficult to respond to the question of does that look right. From an individual perspective, SARS' own statistics confirm that we're probably looking at less than 30% of individuals paying more than 70% of the total tax collection from individuals. But given the current income disturbances, I think that probably is right. And certainly, as regards the difference between VAT collection, collection of taxes from corporates and from individuals, we have seen a substantial growth. I think that growth under normal circumstances might probably be inappropriate, but in the current scenario where consumption and spending has declined and corporate profits have declined, my suggestion is that this is probably to be expected, as long as it's not the same. As regards the position of the taxpayers, there was a question about whether I was making this comment about relatively neutral, just purely from perception, and it was not about doing a survey of taxpayers and asking them, what do you think? This was actually just about the numbers, and I wanted to address the question also about bracket creep and where exactly do we stand. There's no doubt, if I had to draw a line in the sand, there's no doubt that individual taxpayers are without doubt worse off. The bans have been increased, but that they have not been increased sufficiently to compensate for inflation in the bracket key, and to compensate for the further extent to which they're going to be out of pocket as a result of increased fuel bills. And my comment was perhaps more about the extent. If things are marginally better, you don't find us tax practitioners jumping out and up and down and saying things are really great, they were really great, let me say something. And similarly, I think we are on the wrong side of the line, but it's not so substantially significant from a numbers perspective that warranted a particular objection in our commentary over here. And I'm dealing with the questions not necessarily in the order that they were asked, but just in the order that they apply to the issues on our submissions. As regards the environmental measures, we had a question about
best practice, international best practice, and there are substantial, I mean, a lot of work has been done on this particular matter. The whole question of cap and trade and the question of saleable carbon credits, that's one separate issue. But the separate matter of encouraging behavior, and once you turn to the current, it's called Section 12L of the Income Tax Act, which attempts to encourage environmentally responsible behavior. But all it does is, let me not get into the detail. What it does is just offer a very limited incentive if you were in any event intending to undertake some energy savings. So for those who do not have energy savings on the agenda, there aren't any incentives at all that would promote, that would encourage them to change their behavior. On the issue, again, coming back to perception, comments about devil in the detail and my concern that anti-avoidance provisions are drafted too broadly, and I'm referring specifically to comments 7 and 8 in my submission. I want to assure members that this is not a matter of perception. This is a matter of actual real-life experience, having been in this particular chamber, having witnessed legislation being drafted over the past almost two decades now. The first point that I have not seen a single, and I know this is a very broad statement, I have not seen a single anti-avoidance provision in the last 4 or 5 years that has not been drafted on the principle of hurt and let do. In other words, just shoot out everything and then ask afterwards, is there anyone innocent here who shouldn't have been attacked? Certainly, we've had some very heated debates in this chamber with National Treasury, before this committee, on this precise point. And in fact, the reason that I have raised this is not because it's some niggling academic concern that I have, but because this is in fact the experience that we've had every single time. And in fact, the way that it's been, the actual language that was used in the budget proposals, which was not intended to be technical legislative language, it was just supposed to be plain English. Even in the language there, it was clear that we are going to be hitting innocent bystanders here, and that is always a concern. On the question of company cars versus just buying your own car, if I could summarize the difference as being, at the moment, it's probably marginally more favorable to have a company car. The big difference, of course, is that at the end of 3 years, you don't have a car. The car is belonging to your employer, but you would have had the same use. And if, as an alternative, you were to have an increased salary and buy your own car, then you would be marginally worse off from a tax perspective. But at the end of the 3 years, you would have a car. Yes, it is substantially depreciated value, but you would have a car. So my point here was that at the moment, these two alternatives, number one, give me the cash and I'll buy my own car, or number two, just give me the free use of a car. From a tax perspective, there's not a huge difference as we. So my point was, I wasn't really sure what these abuse or salary sacrifice was being attacked over here. I hope that addresses the question. On the question of the relaxation of controls that I was referring specifically to some degree to a relaxation of tax rules, but also more specifically to the relaxation of exchange controls. The current problem that exchange controls create, not so much of a problem for us, we live here, but if a foreign multinational, whether it's headquarters wherever, the UK, Malaysia, South America, wherever, if they came to South Africa and they said to us, okay, we want to establish a headquarters in South Africa and we want to use that as a base for expanding into the rest of Africa, then that headquarters in South Africa suddenly becomes subject to our exchange control rules. That means they need to go to the Reserve Bank for permission to flow funds to South Africa. And their funds coming from offshore that they want to flow through South Africa and expand into the rest of Africa, but they need our permission. So the relaxation of that rule is a particular problem at the moment, and I think that is what the Minister of National Treasury was kind of referring to in the budget. That's the thing that we welcome. I hope that they clarify that one.
I also had a question on the industrial incentive, which is on item 16 on page 4. And I just wanted to get pretty specific, if I can, to you from the current section 12I, Carl Capital I of the Income Tax Act, 12I subsection 10, which says the Minister of Finance, in consultation with the Minister of Trade and Industry, must make regulations prescribing, and it lists a whole lot of rules after that. Now, those regulations were published in draft for comment in March 2009, and it was in the media, and everyone went, woohoo, you know, things happening, and then nothing. So, I mean, we expect the process to be draft, published for comment, we take your comment, and then we do the final regulation. The final regulation has still not arrived. So that's the kind of example that I was referring to. I'm not sure that I... Yeah, those are all of the questions that I think I referred to. I don't know if you want to
thank you.
Thank you,
Professor Mr. Bombay. That covers your questions. Thank you for your presentation on behalf of your organization. We will then call the South African Institute for Tax Practitioners, Mr. Stian Kluw. And after that, in Asa here. Oh, there.
Good afternoon, Honourable Chairman and members of the House. I'm Stian Kluw from the South African Institute of Tax Practitioners. We're one of the leading institutes in Africa who represents tax practitioners with ACCA, SAICA, and SAICA. Although we're a member-based organisation, we also look at broader tax policy as well as the development of the tax profession in Africa. So, from that perspective, we have drafted and commented on the 2010 budget speech. I had an idea of what my colleague is going to talk about, so I didn't really go into too much detail into the particular aspects of the budget. However, with the growing budget deficit, I think we would like to comment on the way to improve tax administration, as well as commenting on tax burden. So if I can start off with my executive summary, I'm going to have some general comments on our expenditure, because currently we know it's difficult to increase the tax burden as well as increase taxes. Although we can boost the tax base, I'm going to have a comment on the budget and then as well as the expenditure which we incur. Then also tax burden on taxpayers, tax commission deadlines, and the interest exemption. Overall, we would like to congratulate the Minister for pragmatic and well-balanced budget. It was certainly a difficult task to balance the job creation, addressing that issue of job creation, long-term sustainable growth, poverty, improvement in service delivery, etc. Now, broadly, we suggest that the answer would be to fund the budget proposals in terms of improving general tax compliance, broadening the tax gap, getting more people into the tax net to pay tax, instead of burdening the existing tax base even further, and most probably using them for foreign countries where those skills will be utilized, so we rather want to keep them here, so therefore broaden the tax base and improve the general tax compliance. And if I could just comment on that, my colleague has mentioned the tax ombudsman, a proposal on a tax ombudsman. Our view would be that if you have a tax ombudsman who looks after the interests of taxpayers, you would immediately improve tax compliance culture and tax morality. money back for what they paid, that has a negative impact on the compliance culture of a taxpayer, as well as those who are not yet taxpayers, who are supposed to be taxpayers, but you do not want to come to me because they look at the potholes, they look at the poor healthcare system, poor education system, and they say, well, I'm not getting anything, so why should I pay? Let's cut corners. Closing loopholes, tax avoidance, improved tax administration, which is extremely important, and improved public sector efficiency. Honourable Chairman, the overall efficiency in government spending is very poor when looking at the outcomes. Now, education expenditure as a percentage of GDP is well above the world average and has remained this way for quite a number of years. This is the biggest single expenditure item on the African budget. Now, Honourable Chair, the problem is not the amount of money that we spend, but rather the outcome of our education system. And that is just one example which I would like to give for this moment. Now, in all international tests of the African learners, such as the progress in international reading literacy study and trends in international mathematics and science studies, that African learners come last. African countries who spend much less than Africa, such as Botswana and Ghana, come ahead of African learners. Moreover, Mr. Chair, when comparing these results of high school finishes across 19 emerging market economies, that Africa comes second last. When comparing the entry into tertiary education, South Africa comes last among all emerging markets and developed countries. This happens despite Africa spending well above the average on education. Out of 40 countries that have part in these studies in reading and literature, South Africa comes last, while the average age of African learners and students was 1.9 years older than the average of the international students. To put this into perspective, given a chart on slide 7 to plot where South Africa is in terms of spending on education as a percentage of GDP, you'll see there that Tunisia, Malaysia, Mexico, Poland is just above, but the world average, we're still above the world average, although our students come either the second last or last in these studies that have been done internationally. Looking at those tests that was done in 2006 on selected countries, you again see the that South Africa comes last out of 600 students which have been tested. This leads to the fact that the African labour force is poorly integrated when compared to other emerging markets, and that South Africa has less than a third of the tertiary education workforce than the emerging market average. Now, Honourable Mr. Chair, if our African labour force is so poorly educated, it will result in a poor uptake in the workforce of school leavers. And in turn, we would generate less revenue and taxes from these individuals, because they either been taken into a very low level, of employment, a vehicle earning less, as well as economic growth would also then be hampered by this fact. Now, while the developing countries generally have few people working as a percentage of the population, it is becoming clear that Africa is at the lower end of the spectrum. This leads, again, to a high tax burden on those individuals who are in the workforce and who are paying tax. Many states take into account overall taxes as a ratio of the population employed. One can see that economically active South Africa has one of the highest burdens in the world. This situation is not supportive of attracting international talent to Africa, which currently we experience as a severe skill shortage. Now, on my slide, I've also included a chart for the university exemption ratios of selected emerging market countries. Now, you'll see the World Education Indicator mean, the blue line, and then you can see that Africa, again, is lost. On the graph. Then, chart 4, education of the workforce compared to the world education indicator. The blue lines of Africa 3.6 and recently on 5.9, we have that the OECD is zero. That would mean that South Africa, the people who leave school is higher than the world average, as well as those of the developing countries who are part of the OECD. Then, unfortunately, my slide, I also have examples on healthcare, which didn't print on the slide that you had in front of you, but I would just like to quickly comment on a second example of the poor service delivery of government, as well as the bank will buy their taxpayer debt for paying taxes. In terms of African countries, the Africa comes last in terms of the healthcare system and giving back to its citizens. And that clearly has an impact on the tax compliance culture of Africa. So taking into account the expenditure on healthcare as well as education, it is important that we look at improving the service delivery of our government rather than raise taxes. If we are more efficient in spending the money, then we don't have to raise taxes to address the issue. Now, Honourable Chief, moving on to the tax burden, with that in mind, if we have a look at the tax burden, now, we discuss on the one hand how we improve or how we can stretch our rank. It's important to look at service delivery, it's important to look at the efficiency of spending our areas. But on the other hand, we also have to look at the existing tax burden on not all the tax South Africans, but only on those who are paying taxes. Now, first of all, we welcome the 6.5 billion relief that has been given to taxpayers. However, that's been taken up now in the fuel levy, other increases in taxes. So, in effect, that doesn't really mean much. Maybe that will be a perception, group of perception for general taxpayers, and therefore, obviously, that will be generally good for tax compliance. However, Mr. Chair, currently 25% of individual taxpayers pay 75% of all personal income tax. This is massive to anybody's terms of need. Only 0.25% of companies in Africa pay 55% of corporate taxes, while less than 5% of companies pay 91% of all company tax. This is a huge burden by any standard of need, and we have to address this issue in future. Although the Honourable Minister mentioned in the budget speech that we will have to look at increasing taxes in future. Then, lastly, there on my point there on slide 12, we recommend that the tax base is more aggressive rather than increasing and burdening the existing taxpayers further, either this year or next year. Just looking at the ratio of taxes to GDP, and what paid employees to the population, you can see the in terms of the countries listed as USA, Japan, Canada, Germany, UK, Czech Republic, Korea, New Zealand, France, South Africa has the highest ratio of taxes to GDP and paid employees in terms of the population. So if you take up the equation, the existing 40 million citizens of Africa do not pay tax. The only way that employees can pay employment, South Africa still has a very, very high tax burden. So, and that also creates antagonism against the tax system in terms of government. So in future, you'll probably see more activism in terms of citizens standing up and saying, we cannot carry this tax burden anymore. We want to see delivery. On that graph, the slide 14, we have taken the rate of tax related to GDP in terms of other countries, and you will see that we have one of the highest rate of tax to GDP in the world compared to those countries listed on the graph. If the honourable members of the House would like to know where the source comes from, I will gladly insert that into the written submission that we sent through. Then moving on to the tax submission deadlines. in November last year, the tax practitioners has really been inundated with taxpayers asking to bring the tax affairs up to date. So tax practitioners need to plan for the year ahead and to not allow sufficient time for tax practitioners to attend to their clients, and the taxpayers will just disaster the non-compliance of taxpayers. So we also proposed to start last year that we have staggering deadlines for certain levels of companies, for example, in terms of turnover or incorporated versus non-incorporated or provisional taxpayers. Hopefully, in future, we can see that to ensure that more taxpayers become compliant and file the tax returns on time. Then on the interest exemption, again, we welcome the increase in the interest exemption. However, it is still not sufficient, Honourable Chair, to encourage individuals to save in Africa. We really recommend this, and we recommend this every year, that the interest exemption is increased significantly, not only 10% per annum, but significantly, just let's say 50,000 rand, to encourage South African taxpayers and South Africans to save. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Verwey from Idasa. If you are ready, you're welcome to come and do your presentation.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Member. Thank you for this opportunity. Len Trevay from UDASA. And I sincerely hope that my comments will be interesting for you today, will be of use in your important work. And might I just say by way of introduction, particularly now given the amendment powers available to Parliament as well, which is I think a welcome extension of your authority over the budget. I didn't catch the Vedusa and FST submissions. The previous two that I did listen to were very much engaged with the micro aspects, perhaps, of tax policy. Our submission is much more general. My aim is, in fairly simple terms, perhaps, to sketch out where I believe we are with regards to the broad picture of public finances. I've entitled the presentation some perspectives on resource availability over the MTPS. Most of what I'm going to share with you comes from the budget review, less the budget speech, but the budget review, so it's the Minister's and National Treasury's own figures as well. And as I say, I think there's quite a few interesting things that come out of that I have linked to the previous presentations as well, which were grappling with one dimension of how to get us out of the situation we find ourselves in with regards to large deficits amongst the citizens. I want to start, you've seen these figures before, but I've just put them in the first slide. Before I continue, let me apologize. This presentation is very heavy in terms of graphs and figures. I hope that my comments will be sufficiently charming and interesting to not make this a very heavy presentation. I'll do my best. I think we all know, but I've put this down just to make it very clear. The huge, I call it the year of divergence, which it was 2009-10. I do believe that in the course of that year, through circumstances that were not South Africa's fault, if I can put it that way, you know, things fundamentally changed. This is for the same fiscal year, so it's not the one we're discussing now, it's for the 2009-2010 fiscal year. But if this compares what Minister of Finance of the time, Trevor Manuel, proposed in February 2009 with what we a sort of a revised estimate of what the outcome is likely to be. And as you know, we were banking on a moderate growth of 1.4%. reality is now looking at the contraction of about 1.5%. These figures are not final, but the ones I'm using come from the budget review. So this is National Treasury's assessment as well at the moment. Gross tax revenue, you can see a difference there of about 70 billion. This is, of course, the media to members. At the same time, we saw a slight increase in expenditure, about 10 billion, through adjustments, and we can talk about it a bit later. As a result of which, we have a substantially larger deficit outcome. This is all very clear and familiar to members, but it is still fully definitive because 2009-2010 really put public finances in a different context with regards to risk as well. This is just a visual representation of sort of a broader view of the last few years. This goes from 2003-04 all the way through to the projections for the last year covered by the medium-term expenditure framework, 2012-13. And I find it quite interesting that just to look at this, you can see that 2003-04, a very small deficit, you can see that what were fairly controversial by the time budget surpluses of 2006-07 and 2007-08. You can see 2008-09, we had a very small deficit, and then you can see the substantial opening up there of 2009-10, and you can see those lines not really converging within this medium-term expenditure framework. So, you know, in very simple terms, and as you know as well, continued deficit being the reality. This is in terms of nominal values. I've just used Treasury's inflation forecast to also convert this to real figures. In other words, taking away the effects of inflation. You can see that the pink line, as one would expect, increasing, but slower when we take the effects of inflation away. What's interesting about revenue is for me at least, is that it allows us to get an idea of when in South Africa, in terms of real tax revenue available, we're going to be back in the position we were in 2007-2008. You'll see in real terms tax revenue peaked there. And there was in fact a slight decline in 2008-09, and you see the very large decline in 2009-10. And you see the recovery. But if one uses National Treasury figures, this implies that even in 2012-13, real tax revenue then will only be comparable to 2007-08. I mean, I hope this adds also the broad perspective to some of the remarks of the previous presentations about the problem we find ourselves in with regards to tax revenue and its ability to finance very needed public spending. Still using National Treasury estimates, these are the assumptions on tax recovery for the three main taxes over this period. And I think it's part of an interesting discussion is to assess the validity of these assumptions, of course. But you can see, first of all, the blue line on top is personal income tax. And this is in real terms, has taken away the effect of inflation. You can see it more or less remaining stable, and the anticipation of a fairly quick and substantial recovery over this medium-term expenditure framework. The blue line going on. You can see the value-added tax, that's the yellow line. You can see the quite sharp decline as you know, households cut down their consumption, especially 2008-09, 2009-10, and a very gradual, not particularly spectacular recovery in VAT receipts through to 2012-13. And then you can see, quite clearly, in terms of the pink line, which is corporate income tax, the very sharp decline from 2008-09 to 2009-10, and if these figures are reliable, and I have no reason to think that they're not, very little prospect of recovery in terms of corporate income tax contribution to tax revenue over this medium-term expenditure framework. The next slide just links the sort of changes in tax revenue for these three main taxes and compares them to anticipated growth, real GDP growth. And you can see there so the green is real GDP growth. You can see the blue, the anticipation or the hope of any strong recovery in personal income tax. And you can see the, you know, not positive performance of corporate income tax as well as VAT I think the question obviously needs to be asked about how realistic these are, because a lot depends on the recovery of tax revenue and our assumptions about that. All right, let me just go back on this.
Yeah.
This is also will be familiar to members. This is the main budget balance as we are looking at it under the medium-term expenditure framework. So you can see the very substantial deficit for 2009-10, as well as the continued large deficit, clearly in the face of very significant decreases in tax revenue. If you want to maintain expenditure, you have to borrow. And this is what is currently on the table, 7%, 6, 5, 4%. Of course, as a result of that, fairly significant increases as well in debt servicing as a percentage of GDP. I've restricted this to the medium-term expenditure framework period, so up to 2012-2013. Treasury's sense is that this will debt service as a percentage of GDP will keep on increasing until 2015. So if one were to include that, you know, things would look, you know, even less optimistic with regards to the amount of money from the fiscus going to social debt. You can see as well, of course, how it declined from 2003-04. As you know, the economy was doing very well. We had high growth. We had budget surpluses. Debt service as a percentage of GDP declined quite rapidly and quite markedly until 2008-2009. I think to come to one of the sort of the crux issues really is of course how sustainable is this debt? How does our situation now compare, for example, to the situation in the 80s or the 90s, when we know that a substantial amount of public money was allocated to servicing debt. So I've taken a very long-term view. The first year there, probably not clear, it's certainly not clear on my side, is the slide of 1985-1986. And you can see the rise in the debt stock. This is the value at one time of debt. It's not debt service payments, which would also be a function of interest rates, of course. But it gives one a sense of how that compares. Now, this kind of slide doesn't imply that you know, South Africa is heading for a significant debt trap, in the sense that we perhaps know it from, let's say, from Latin American economies. Certainly not. But if you recall in the mid-90s through to about 2001-2002, substantial amounts of the fiscus was allocated to servicing debt. And of course, that crowded out a lot of other needed spending initiatives. And remember, again, I'm only going up to 2013. That rising blue line would, in my view, rise to just under 50% again by 2015. Treasury's estimate in their budget review is about 48%, 45 to 48%. So debt stock as a percentage of GDP would peak at about 45 to 48% in 2015. Now, that's assuming that at that point, somehow, we are able to curtail these deficit trends. So it also, of course, assumes that the economy recovers in a fairly healthy fashion, 3, 4%, perhaps slightly higher than 4% in 2013-14. So I'll show you some other slides that I think also make a similar point, but clearly the situation as it stands now is that by about 2013-2014, there'll be a risk of crowding out of other new spending initiatives as a result of the need to service debt. What we're already seeing, the fundamental point here, of course, is that we are incurring fairly large deficits in order, essentially, to maintain spending commitments. South African economy was in a very, you know, prosperous set of circumstances from about 2003 to 2007. I think it was regarded as the appropriate time also to engage in infrastructural spending to address some of the bottlenecks in the economy. So that started happening, and then the crisis hit. Now, in order to maintain very small nominal increases in our spending, which is what we are continuing to do, we have to run these deficits. This gives you an idea of just the increases over this medium-term expenditure framework period in some in the key spending categories as the budget book also organized them. That looks pretty healthy, but when we adjust it for inflation and we look at real changes, I apologize if this is not particularly legible, it is quite small. This is real increases or decreases. And you can see particularly in the change from the maroon to the yellow. So that's from the fiscal year that we're starting now and how 2011-2012 compares to that. You'll see across many of these categories, real decreases in spending. The notable exception, obviously, on the far right is debt costs. One cautionary remark, I haven't included the contingency reserve allocation in here. You'll see it on the far right. That would make things possibly look a bit better. But if you look at almost any of them, if you take health, for example, and you look at the relationship between the maroon line, which is 2010-11 allocation, and the yellow line, so that would be 2011-12, you see a real decline. The same holds for education. The same holds for social protection. Economic affairs very clearly declining from 2009-10 all the way through to 2013 as well. This doesn't reflect obviously a lack of commitment on the part of government to any of these priorities. This reflects the changing reality of what we are able to do with the resources that are likely to be available. Whether this budget is realistic or not, that's an interesting question, but it's certainly preferable to have a slightly pessimistic budget, which this is, or a slightly pessimistic medium-term expenditure framework. And the assumption of growth is 3 and then 3.5%. So on that kind of growth, which is in line with sort of perhaps consensus view, this is the kind of situation we're facing. And we're not facing it this year particularly. We are facing it from 2011-12. As I said, if you add in the contingency reserve amounts, which are on the far right, it's a fairly substantial amount, especially for 2012-13, which is still unallocated. Things will look a bit better, but that contingency reserve is not going to appreciably change the fact that we're looking at real decreases in spending on priorities. So there's much less room to maneuver. Just put it in numbers for you as well. What I've done now is I've included the contingency reserve for these calculations. This gives us the changes. From 9-10 to 10-11, in other words, the change from the year that's coming to an end now to the year that's lying ahead of us, looking at a real increase of 3.3%. But again, particularly interesting, if we go from 10-11 to 11-12, that's an increase of 1.6% in real terms. That is less than any sort of even very pessimistic assumption of economic growth. So in other words, one result of that would be that government's share in the economy would in fact decline. Perhaps a basic point, but of course if your public spending is increasing at a slower rate than your GDP, then your government share in the economy declines slightly. Right. So in a way, well not in a way, I mean I think it's quite clear that over this medium-term expenditure framework, the Southern government has much less resources to work with and is in a sort of a holding pattern mode, not through any lack of commitment, and as you know, we can hardly take credit, if you like, for causing the global financial crisis, but the impact of that is very much still rippling through. What this implies as well is that certainly you can fund new initiatives, but you're going to have to do that through reallocation within available resources rather than assume, as we did from, let's say, like 2003 to 2007, that there's always going to be additional money coming available to fund the initiatives. So it's a matter now of reallocation as well as belt tightening, which I will comment on briefly towards the end. The obvious question then is whether there's any indication of a genuine crowding out of social spending.
I've made the point that debt costs are going to increase a bit, that resources are constrained. Based on this slide, which I'll comment on now, I don't think we can say that. If you look, this is the share of total spending taken by various categories. I've just put in social protection, health, education, and the debt cost. The green line is the debt cost, and you can see it rising through this MTEF period. Bearing in mind, as I have mentioned, that it would probably peak, well, the debt stock would peak in 2015. Debt service costs might peak even later than that. As a share of spending, however, the other allocations remain pretty constant and pretty high. It's just that in real terms, they are increasing very little. The question, obviously, then, is given this set of circumstances, which I think is not an interpretation on our part, but simply a reflection of where public finances are, what are some possible solutions, what do we need to think about? You know, it's as simple as saying if you've got this kind of problem, you can either spend less, tax more, or borrow more. Those are your options in the short term. In the medium and longer term, you're, of course, hoping for higher, possibly spectacular economic growth to sort out these problems. But in the medium term, spending moderation is clearly required and has occurred. I think, let me stress that. So I wouldn't say that spending moderation hasn't occurred. I think if we look at the medium term expenditure framework, we see that that's precisely what's happening. I don't think it's necessarily clear to everybody who's interested in the budget that we are heading for a very resource-tight period. So this spending moderation is already in the allocation. Value for money, the Minister of Finance has used that phrase on a number of occasions. Somehow improving the relationship between your allocation and your outcome. And I'm sure members of this committee have had many discussions about this as well. It's comparatively simple to say we need better value for money. It's far from clear, certainly to myself, how you achieve that. Because it's not about narrow financial compliance here, it's about institutions, it's about people, management systems, it's about all the problems that we have, not just in South African government, for example, but in South African society. It's not a simple thing. One key dimension, though, which is particularly relevant to this committee and to Parliament, is, of course, oversight. And we can talk a bit about that as well, about what effective oversight might entail in this kind of environment. Tax compliance, I'm not going to comment on that further because I think some of the previous two presentations did discuss that. I'm a little bit surprised because I had thought that we were doing quite well with regards to tax compliance. And 2, 3, 4 years ago, from the Minister of Finance at the time, we seem to be making continuous inroads in terms of improving tax compliance. So for me, it's an interesting question to pose to this committee as well. Was that not true? Or what has changed? Because one certainly has a sense, when the current Minister of Finance was Commissioner of Sales as well, that tax compliance was improving quite spectacularly. A fourth area to look at is, well, I've put together here the areas of social capital and allocative efficiency. We need, especially perhaps in the context of amendment powers available to Parliament, to ensure that the budget is responsive to citizens' preferences. Allocative efficiency meaning that what the services are provided have the best chance of actually contributing to social well-being. That's also an area where I think gains can be made. No bells and whistles, okay, that was also emphasized by the Minister, to cut out some of the frozen public spending. And the last other question I put in there, tax increases, I have my own opinions about that, we can discuss it perhaps, but for the moment I'm going to end there and hope you have some questions or comments on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tobay, and to Mr. Kuhn, all the members. Questions? George? Colonel? Wesley?
Thank you.
Chair, for me. I only have one question. Mr. Kui, you mentioned on page number 2, on your last slide, under tax burden, recommended that the tax base be broadened aggressively. Do you have any idea of how this actually can be achieved? And then, Mr. Favey, on your slide, page 3, your slide about optimistic, pessimistic tax revenue, the way I understand it, you are saying, or you're showing, the slide is quite difficult to read, black and white. It seems that you are showing that as the GDP rises, revenue increases. If you can just confirm that that's what you're saying. Thank you, Chair.
Well,
thank you, Chairperson. I think, you know, what we're seeing here is to just to, in essence, to say how difficult times we are in. And for the next 3 years, if we compare it with the, you know, 6 years terms, two MTF periods of the previous terms to the next six, we're going to see it's going to be very, very tough. Now, what I want to ask is, if we look at our debt, and say, for instance, we start to grow, and domestic spending patterns return, they will go to the capital markets, you know, for credit. At the same time, SOEs will be in the same market trying to raise funds and to incur more debt. And obviously, government is going to be there. And they say that is the time when the titans will clash. What will happen then? Will we have an enormous hike in interest rates? And what will happen to the economy with regard to that? The second question is, obviously, if we do not see value for money, we are in serious trouble. And the problem is, it's very difficult for government to create value for money. You know, it's not a thing that you do like that. And we have seen that the president said in his State of the Nation, we want, this is the year of action. But it is going to be very difficult for South African out of a civil service point of view, you know, just to create that action and then to see value for money. Now, if we don't see it this year, what will be the impact?
Thanks, Jefferson. Mr. Clue. The presentation that I've been listening from him, it looks like it was coming from the Ratepayers Association. I just wanted him to really talk to slide number 14. Because the manner in which he has presented, and it looks like we are sitting on a time bomb where people may rise and say, what are we paying for? But then slide 14 is actually talking to tax burden. But then when one looks at the figures attached to our country in relation to the rest that has been picked up on the table, it doesn't look like we are bad. If we can just talk to that, also in relation to the assertions that he has made in relation to education and the rest is service delivered. Then on the on the IDASA, on page 2, I just want to understand whether they are not over pessimistic about the trend on the tax, whether the projection of a flatter graph, or whether it is based on everything staying constant. And because the previous year, I think on the 2008-2009, and then we had a sharper decline. And if everything is not staying constant, and we have got this government intervention, infrastructure intervention, why are we not expecting a sharp rise? What stops us from expecting a sharp rise? Although it may not be a rise to the same level over the 2008-2009, but I'm interested to know what informs a projection of a flatter graph in the next 3 years. Are we not over pessimistic?
Thanks, Chair. Just a quick question for the Institute of Tax Practitioners. The slide on interest exemption, you suggest a radical increase in interest exemption. Can you give us an estimate on the cost of that to tax? And then, Chair, if you allow me, just a quick point. In my opinion, the point of these public hearings is so that the committee can gather the opinion of the broad base of South Africans on the budget and feed it back to the minister, and now from this year actually use that information to actually amend the budget as we see fit. Now, a certain amount of analysis is helpful, but actually what's really useful to us is more solid input on reforms required to the budget according to the people that come and brief us. In my opinion, the earlier presentations were much more useful in that respect. So to whoever's still in the room and has presented today, not only feedback would be we need more solid input into reform and less analysis, if I may. Thank you.
Any other questions? You can respond, Mr. Clue.
Question one, how can we achieve the more better tax base broadening? One of the main things we should do is to educate the taxpayers on the responsibility to pay tax, as well as the impact on that the paying the tax has on the country and the dependent African. So there's the we should incorporate a social responsibility element into that. Then secondly, we should look at compliance agreements. The Dutch has successfully implemented a system of horizontal monitoring. And currently, the first of all explain the difference between horizontal monitoring and vertical monitoring. Vertical monitoring is the system which you currently have in Africa, where you look when you audit a taxpayer after he has submitted the return, whereas our horizontal monitoring is more an upfront relationship with the taxpayer, kind of a gentleman's agreement. For example, as the revenue authority would engage with the industry, for example, let's say Actavac or let's take another example, AngloGold. AngloGold wants to enter into a merger or acquisition and therefore invite SARS, and so this is how we see, how we interpret the legislation. This is what we're going to do. This is what we plan. What do you think? Do you agree? Do you disagree? It's not a ruling or an opinion, but it's more an open relationship. That is horizontal monitoring. Now, what has happened in the Netherlands is that the revenue authority, the Dutch revenue authority, has entered into compliance agreements with the AngloGold, the Shell, the corporates, whereby they agree that to participate and to have an open relationship. It does not take away the audit function of revenue, but if both parties are certain about the tax risk, then obviously you would have less risk from a revenue body perspective as well as from the taxpayer, because upfront they are more certain about their risk. And now, recently, last year, the then commissioner of SARS, Pravin Bordhan, entered into an agreement of that nature with the banking association. We would like to see that to be extended to other corporates to make sure that the horizontal monitoring aspect
and that we also address the issue of staff shortages within SARS, as well as staff shortages, because then there would be less staff needed to do audits afterwards. Obviously, we still have to do vertical monitoring audits, but if we can act proactively with taxpayers, that will certainly create a better environment and will definitely improve the compliance culture. Then the more controversial issue is those taxpayers who are tax industries. We need to start engaging with this kind of compliance with the tax industry, making sure that the taxi operators, those come into the tax net. There are various cash-based entrepreneurs in Africa, and I've recently heard figures. If you look at a cash-based organization like a CAFE, some of them can even sell up to R600,000, or their purchases for cigarettes is R600,000 per month. Not per annum, on the method, per month. So last year we saw the introduction of turnover tax for micro businesses with a turnover of less than R1 million. Subsequently, we found out that threshold is way too low. If you look at these informal businesses that the purchasing of cigarettes only is R600,000 per month. So we have to engage with the relevant industry bodies, like the tax association, even with the corporate. Now, my colleague mentioned the tax administration bill, which is currently out for comment, and the comment is due tomorrow to SARS. That legislation, once enacted, will provide SARS with the ability and the power to call in, for example, the tobacco companies, and say, who are your clients? And therefore, obtain the information to audit and to reach out to those cash businesses. So I think we have to be proactive again, because that will probably have a negative impact if you call in the tobacco companies. So to reach a broadening tax base, as I mentioned to you, these cash businesses, informal cash businesses, with turnovers of more than R1 million a month. So that's certainly an important way to broaden and aggressively broaden the tax base. On the comment of how do we collect taxes on my clients falling compared to rich countries, yes, I agree with honourable member that at face value it looks like we are okay, but if you look at those countries and if you do proper investigation as to what those countries give back to the citizens, for example, in countries like Australia, they have a social security system, they have a full paid healthcare system, they have free tertiary education. So that is the thing that we don't have. So if you add that plus your security expense to your existing burden for taxpayers, we are really, really one of the highest tax countries in the world. On the interest exemption, which we recommend should be increased drastically, it's difficult to say what the cost would be on tax and what we would collect less tax. I would predict that it would be very minimal. R50,000, if you are a rich person who can invest an interest-bearing account capital, first of all, you are already taxed on that in terms of your salary or your business income. So this is a form of double tax. So by increasing that to, let's say, R50,000 or even R100,000, that will just encourage individuals to save. And the cost would be minimal to the fisc in terms of loss revenue. So I don't have figures. Thank you very much for the question.
Thank you. I'm just going to refer to the slides where relevant puts up the response to any questions.
Yeah, the first question was clarificatory in terms of the slides. Honourable Member, you're quite correct. This shows tax revenue, the main tax revenue, is increasing in real terms as the economy recovers. Yes. I think, however, I put this slide in to make a related point, also quite a simple point, which is that not all tax revenues recover at the same rate as the economy recovers, which is the problem. You can see particularly in the change from 09-10 to 10-11, so the first set of four columns there, you can see an anticipated recovery in real GDP of, let's say, 2.5%, but still a contraction in corporate income tax revenue. So, technically speaking, the elasticities are not necessarily positive. The second question was about government lending, FOE lending, the household lending, as household income also improves, and the problem of crowding out. I think that would definitely be a risk. The fact that ESCOM is, amongst other things, looking to the World Bank for loan financing of its infrastructure indicates that an awareness that domestic savings are not going to finance all of this borrowing without interest rates rising appreciably. So there might be the need to look increasingly at foreign sources of financing to manage all of this and keep interest rates moderate. As you know, in the wake of the recession, global interest rates are currently quite low, so I guess it is an option. But as you also know, international borrowing is more subject to exchange rate risk, amongst other things. The second question from the Honourable Member there was about value for money, and if it doesn't happen this year, then what? I think I would just emphasise my point that value for money is always important. In a resource-scarce environment, it becomes increasingly important. And then just to add, again, the comment I made earlier, it's not a simple thing to achieve, though. It's also about all South Africans, about multi-stakeholder oversight. As vague as that sounds, I don't think there's a specific one aspect of it that one can identify to say, if we do this right, we'll get better value for money. The final question coming to me was about whether some of the tax revenue projections were perhaps pessimistic. I provided three. Let me just find them. So it's the personal income tax, corporate income tax, and the VAT. Personal income tax looks, you know, that's reasonably optimistic, if you like. I don't mean that as a valuation of it, whether it's realistic or not. But I think the Honourable Member's comments were more on the other two, the corporate income tax and the VAT. In the case of the VAT, we think the point there is that the South African households were quite indebted going into the crisis, and that is probably what's going to retard spending. Households are indebted. So even if their income rises, they are going to be more likely to be servicing their own debt rather than going on a new consumption spree, which would give us substantially more VAT revenue. So I think that it's a function of where South African households were. And I mean, in the sense, South African households did what many households have done throughout history. When things were good, they assumed they were just going to carry on being good and getting better. So they got more and more indebted in a boom period. And that certainly increased our vulnerability to the crisis, but more specifically, our ability to spend our way out of it, if you like. With regards to the corporate income tax, that for me is a much more tricky one because, in my view, the South African fiscal authorities have often struggled to correctly predict corporate income tax. If the Honourable Member will recall, when we had budget surpluses in two previous fiscal years, that was through collecting substantially more revenue on the corporate income tax than Treasury had anticipated. We seem to struggle to model and correctly predict corporate income tax revenue. That is my view. So yes, it could corporate income tax could look better than this. And personally, I don't see this likely. I also would prefer a budget that is slightly pessimistic to one that is optimistic and therefore has to pay the penalty later by greater short-term loans, but a larger than anticipated. I hope those remarks address the questions.
Thank you.
Sir, it's not necessarily that much to ask. I just wanted to. I just wanted to have some comments on the
the assessment that the minister has made about the gambling winning and other people also raising issues of tax deductions on gambling losses. I haven't heard this morning anybody talking to that particular statement. I'm not sure whether there's no need, because I mean the minister has been clear that he's going to actually review and look at that, and whether it's a good thing to do in relation to the cost that may be incurred in actually managing or administering that particular tax.
Thank you, Honourable Mashida. You are to present this. Honourable Co-Chair, Mahdi will do the closing remarks.
I'm participating. I know in terms of time we need to forever. But maybe with the last question that Honourable Mashida has raised, the response may be that the presenters are winners in the gambling industry, so after they're not talking about it. but more on a serious note, I think this goes to Mr. Klu. Yeah. Your analysis in terms of the tax basis in relation to South African population in terms of PNT vis-a-vis the rest of the world. I think partially you are correct when you compare us with countries such as Australia. But there are other economic variables and social security measures that we use to offset what they are. Let's take education, for instance. Education in Australia has completely been, it has been looked at as a commercial activity for international students. Therefore, international students subsidize the local school goers or, education, basically. To a very large about 25% or so will come from international students. The main issue that I want to talk to, I don't see you drawing a parallel between our social security network with countries that almost have a social security network such as Scandinavia. Because if you go that route, you then realize that the personal income taxes in those countries are as much as high, even probably higher than what PIT is in South Africa because of the social network, security network. But also the levels of poverty. You should draw those parallels, must also factor in the levels of poverty in those countries, such as ourselves. The last point is to Idasa. I think in one of your slides, the debt talk in longer term context, as a simple sense of sustainability. What are you talking about in terms of your analysis? And I agree with the Honorable Chair that, well, of course, this is a learning experience for the first time that we're engaging with the fiscal framework. It is not just about how best can you analyze. It is also about what needs to be done. You know, that's what will help this committee. Because we need to get a view whether you agree with the fiscal framework as it is, or you think it needs to be tweaked around so that you can be able to factor in that which you think is missing. But I think, nonetheless, the analysis is quite useful. Now, in terms of this slide, you see, in 1996-97, your debt-GDP ratio was almost at, just before 1994, we were almost at 48%. And then 96-97, almost at the same level. What you are not telling us is a similarity between that and today. In the sense that if you go back at 96-97, this was the time of the Asian crisis, financial crisis. So today it is as a result of the financial market collapse, the economic crisis. And you can see your debt
GDP ratio is almost going in the same direction. Therefore, for me, what is important, you should also be saying to us, it is important to note the interrelatedness and interdependence of the South African economy, South African economy to the rest of the world, particularly developed countries. Because all the things that you're seeing and observing here, it says to you, they are exogenous factors, or factors that are beyond South African economically, macroeconomic variables. We can deal with these issues. We follow the trends of the world. However, at the same time, it does show you this graph that your debt management through your fiscal and monetary policies, the South African government has actually proven to be very solid and stable in terms of reducing those debts as the economy recovers throughout the world. I thought these are some of the issues that are not coming out of the presentation. Professor Saluji, or is it Saluji? It's gone. Malachi is gone. But since you come from the tech family, you know, one of the things that he mentioned was to say, when you look at the number of companies in terms of company tax in South Africa, you've got quite a number of CCs, and it defines them as owners of means of production. I'm sure if you go to the company register, you'd find that Honorable Mashile has got about 6 or 7 CCs, and they are non-operational. So they can be owners of means of production. So you can use that kind of information to weigh, you know, what is it that you think is in the play in the South African economy. And that is why in the medium-term budget policy statement, the minister said, we are giving incentives for people to deregister. If you don't deregister your CC that is inactive, you'll then be liable to pay certain penalties in terms of keeping that company in your name or whatever. So I just wanted to say, the analysis is good, but you should go a little bit further to actually interrelate our economy with the rest of the world, what has been happening in the past decade.
Very briefly, perhaps, on Jefferson's comment here about the dead stock slide as well. I'm personally not convinced that one sees the East Asian crisis there so much as the fact that one had in 1994-95 a bureaucracy that was opaque, because there didn't seem to be any particular control over public finances at that point. So I think it was very hard for government itself to have a clear picture of what was happening. I do take your remarks seriously about the need for more suggestions. But I had hoped to achieve that, but the reason I actually included this slide, and let me just take a minute, is because I feel that what one sees here is how a quite a precarious debt situation, whatever the causes, necessitated a macroeconomic and debt consolidation policy that was highly unpopular. I'm talking up here now, and has, you know, created a lot of tensions around where budget policy should go. Because I feel that just under 50%, I mean, that was 95-96, and as you know, Pierre was released in 96, specifically to say, among other things, saying that we had a big public finances problem. It certainly wasn't popular at the time, and my point that I make it clearly then is that probably in 2014 or 15, we will sit with a similar situation again, where there will be even greater friction between, for example, the alliance about economic policy, because the debt situation will be similar again. And this suggests that in that case, it required or was perceived to require a quite strong response in terms of curtailing public expenditure. The East Asian crisis certainly had an impact on foreign direct investment, etc. But I would not say that that particularly contributes to the debt. I could be wrong.
Thank you for the comment as well. We much appreciated that you applied your mind to what I said. I think I take the point, and I haven't investigated the fact that those tertiary education are funded by foreign students. However, I think what we should look at, including the tax morale, tax compliance of the compliance culture of South Africans, this is a perception. And it's something that we have to change. If that is indeed the case that we do have actually an average tax burden, that is certainly not felt and seen by the general public and taxpayers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kru and Mr. Suvay. Thank you, honourable members, for those who have left for their presentations. Very clear that we will have to think as a collective, as also the role players out there, to think creatively to get the economy keeping to grow. It's not just a function of government. It's a collective exercise of all role players in South Africa. Also to give our people hope. When we leave here tomorrow afternoon to the constituencies, when you enter the village or the township, the town, they are going to ask you questions and you have to come to the answer. But we must give them the real picture. And this is part of the real picture, to get the think tank, to get all the input. Thank you for your participation. We will break for lunch. The meeting will now be adjourned, and then this meeting will carry on tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock in the same venue, at 9 o'clock, yes, and then we will be having Kusatu, as well as the Business Unity of South Africa. That's the two institutions, organizations that will be presenting their papers to us tomorrow. All the members, this meeting has been adjourned. We meet you again tomorrow. Thank you.
What does that mean?
They won't make one application.